Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack
and Sean Chapman.
This week on the show, we are talking about stuff. Specifically, we're talking about movies this week.
Yes, it's a movie show.
It is, because we are going to be talking about the new movie of the week, which is Mission Impossible Fallout. It's fucking good.
Yeah, it's a really good movie.
I can't wait. I don't know how many coherent thoughts I have because I'm still kind of wired from it.
Yeah, I don't know where our discussion is going to go because it's kind of a movie like, remember he fucking jumped off the thing and did the thing and the thing blew up? That was fucking cool, huh?
Yes.
It's like, definitely one of those movies.
Cranked to 11. Yeah. There's like no shortage of those moments. We're also going to talk about all the other Mission Impossible movies.
Yes.
Because, Sean, for the first time, you did all of them.
Yes, before a week or so ago, like a little bit more than a week ago, I had only seen Mission Impossible 3 when it was in theaters in like 2006. So that was a long time ago. And yeah, so I watched through all of them. We talked about Mission Impossible 1 and 2 last week. And
yes.
And since then, I have rewatched 3 and then watched 4 and 5 for the first time. And then, of course, watched 6 in the theaters.
Yeah. So we will talk about, we'll recap 1 and 2 are good, weird, fun. Then yeah. We'll talk about 3, 4, 5 into 6. Which is interesting, actually, because 6 is very much a sequel to the other movies. In a way, none of the others are sequels to each other.
Yeah, I felt very glad that I had watched through them. Which is something that's like, for the other ones, there's obviously like little things of like, oh, Ving Rhames is in all these movies. And like, there's a little couple of references to maybe like, you know, the wife from Mission Impossible 3 or something in 4 or 5. But generally, those movies you can watch without seeing any of the others. This one feels like you could enjoy it, definitely, without seeing them, but it benefits especially having seen 5.
It's the right level of serialization where it feels like things are paying off.
Yeah.
But also, like, it's you're right. I mean, you could come in clean and then go back and you'd discover, like, oh, that's what that's from. It wouldn't ruin it for you, which is nice.
Yeah.
You know, because not everything should be Avengers Infinity War.
No, yes. It's
in terms of continuity complexity. But yes, we're going to talk about Mission Impossible. I'm going to talk about some Chinese movies, and that'll make more sense when we get there. You're going to talk about some stuff.
Yes.
We're going to talk about a little bit of news. But yeah, we're just going to talk about some cool stuff today. Housekeeping. Sean, this is our last podcast together in Colorado. For now.
Yes, for now. Yes. I suspect at some point you will be back in Colorado.
Yes.
And we'll probably record podcasts then. But well, yeah, of regular, ongoing, weekly podcasts.
Yep. I mean, we will probably always get to do our, like, Doctor Who Christmas special reviews in person, because I assume I'll be back for Christmas.
Probably.
And that is a good time to talk about things. So, yes, until the Weekly Stuff holiday special. yes, but, yeah, you know, I don't know how much I have to say, especially because the next 3 episodes you guys are going to hear have been pre-recorded.
Yeah.
So this is, chronologically for you guys, this is not where the switch is going to happen.
Yes, it's a very weird feeling because we recently recorded episodes 150 and 151.
250 and 251.
250 and 251. Fucking Jesus Christ, what are we doing? But 250, 251. And that felt like a, like, this is actually the, because it was, this is actually the finale, which makes recording this podcast feel weird, because it is actually the finale for us.
Yes. So I'm taking a little hiatus from podcasting for 3 or 4 weeks. You guys will not hear a gap at all, and in fact, the next 3 episodes we have coming your way are really good.
Yeah.
I'm really happy to present those. They're all video game related, so a nice movie episode this week is going to be fun. And then I'll be back for new stuff at the end of August. But again, you guys won't hear any difference until then. And then, like I said, we'll be doing our new remote recording, and it's going to sound nice, and we'll see how it goes.
Yeah.
I, you know, had to try to find good enough internet in Iowa City to support, you know, recording online. It's hard. Iowa City has some good internet, but not necessarily around my house.
Yeah, it's the thing of living in America. You never know. You never know what you're going to get.
I mean, the thing is, I found one company that looks like it's perfect. It's what I want, and I've never heard of them. And I don't know if that's a good thing. That could be a great thing.
That's probably a good thing.
Yeah.
Because nobody likes Xfinity. Nobody likes Time Warner. Like, nobody likes any of the major companies.
So. No, I've dealt with all of them. They fucking suck. All right. Anyway, we're not recording online yet. You can't shut us off yet, motherfuckers.
No.
Last bit of housekeeping is I forgot to open my Mountain Dew. Sean usually reminds me, so a little bit of ASMR for you.
That was sensual.
Yeah, there you go. All right. You know what? It's the last one in Colorado. We're just going to have fun with it.
Fuck it. We're not going to pause or edit that out or anything. We're just going.
We're just going. All right. So, Sean, let's do some stuff. What have you been up to?
I have 2 pieces of stuff. One is mostly just, I feel like, a necessary public service announcement of Crunchyroll has just this week reacquired the license to stream the show Nichijou. That's N-I-C-H-I-J-O-U, also known as My Ordinary Life. And it is one of the best anime series I've ever seen, because Crunchyroll used to have it years ago. Then I think Funimation got the rights to do the English version over here. And then so recently now, as like a fallout of the like, you know, slow kind of like content merger between Crunchyroll and Funimation, has finally gotten back onto Crunchyroll's service. And it is such an outrageously hilarious show. It's about, it's not even really important what it's about. I mean, the main characters are high school girls. There's one half of the show. The other half of the show is an 8-year-old super genius scientific professor who invented a robot girl. And those two sides of the show eventually intersect. But it's basically just skits created around these really compelling, interesting, weird characters. And it's very over the top, very ridiculous. The thing that makes the show extra special, though, is that it legitimately has maybe the best animation in any animated series I've ever seen. It is... Which is the thing that makes that even better is the fact that it is not used for some, like, action epic. It's not fucking Naruto. It's not Dragon Ball Super. And, you know, like, the shows like that of Naruto or Dragon Ball Super have probably individual episodes that are better than what Nichijou does. But as, like, the baseline quality, Nichijou has, I think, 24 or 26 episodes in total.
26?
26.
According to the internet.
And it is utterly stunning how good it is. And it works for the show because... The skits are so ridiculous and so over the top, and there's just, you know, I just, before you came over, Jonathan, I was watching episode 6, which is the one where the school principal suplexes a deer in the school courtyard, and the animation in that whole sequence is just so gorgeous. There's so many frames of animation. It's so carefully detailed. They shift really skillfully between styles of animation depending on what's happening. So there's, I think in episode 2 or episode 3, there's a sequence where one of the main characters, Mio, is trying to race down another main character, Yuko, who has stolen her notebook and seen that she's drawing naughty pictures in her notebook. And so in that sequence, all the colors wash out and it becomes this like very insane sketchbook looking thing as they're speeding down the hallway at ridiculous speeds. It's just it's a hilarious, amazing, incredible show, and people absolutely should check it out because it has been off for a long time on Crunchyroll. Nice. So yeah, it's from the earlier days of Crunchyroll when not a lot of people had that service. So if you do have subscribed to Crunchyroll now, there's a chance that it wasn't on there when you started. So it's time to get on that shit.
I'm also seeing Funimation did do a Blu-ray release of this last year.
Yes.
So if you want it that way, I'm seeing that's which is always nice. Have you ever seen the Isao Takahata film My Neighbors the Yamadas?
No, I haven't.
You would like that, I think, especially based on what you're saying about Nichijou. It sounds like it's piquing my interest because it actually sounds something similar to that, which is that is also, it's a movie, but it's like a sketch comedy kind of movie in animation. It's based on an actually daily comic strip manga, which you don't hear about much, but yeah. That's a thing too, about this family life, and Takahata took that, and it's a very experimentally animated one, so it looks like a moving comic strip. But I was just looking at the art, and like even some of that, it's like, oh, because most anime tends to go for the more like filled in, stylized, like we take the manga and then make it look like, you know, a filled in animated TV show. Yeah. Most don't go the other direction and like pare it down even further, which I always like to see some of
yes.
that.
So, yeah. Anyway,
you should see that as well.
I will check that out. You should check out Nichijou.
I will. That actually sounds good. Because I still have my Crunchyroll. And 26 episodes? Not that much.
Nope. Yeah, and yeah. It fucking flies by.
You're not telling me to watch, like, Naruto or something.
No, yes. It flies by. And I also feel like the show gets better and better as it goes, which is a nice thing of, like, I think it starts really strong, but then the deeper you get in and the more you kind of understand the characters, the deeper the comedy goes. And I'm very excited on this rewatch to get to some of my favorite skits that I remember. There's one, probably my favorite one that I watched on YouTube all the time, and I think it's from like the middle of the series, is this just the best parody of a sports montage I've ever seen, which is one of the girls, I think it's Mio, is trying to train so she can do this stupid like high back jump thing to like go over a pole, and it's just like part of like their PE class, and she's just training for like weeks to be able to do this thing, and like the steps it goes through and the dumb montage song they play is so funny. It's a really good show.
Nice. I'll do a quick stuff here while we're at it. Octopath Traveler, I'm still loving it. It's still good. I'm on the last of the chapter 3s. So I'm close to having just the final chapters left. So I'm excited to see how stories are going to start wrapping up. Loving the game. I'm sure next time you and I are together for a podcast, I will be done with this.
Yes, probably. And you will be done with that. I will be done with Monster Hunter World. And we can talk about the games we've been playing in like a total sense instead of being like, I really like this game. But I still just say that every time we come on the podcast once a week.
But I do still want to talk about... So, I have been taking screenshots. There's a feature in the game where when you either Alfric or Cyrus can do this, where you talk to NPCs in town and you can get like a little like Wikipedia entry for them. I don't know how else to say it. It's honestly the most similar thing I've ever seen like this is the scan visor function in Metroid Prime, where like you scan stuff and you learn about it, but here it's people. Mm-hmm. And there's like a little paragraph of text about all of them. And I want to read some of these because they are one of my favorite things I've ever seen in a video game. They're so fucking great. So here's some of my favorites, Sean.
Okay.
This is in the town of Clearbrook, I think. A 65-year-old woman says, "This old woman was carried to Clearbrook by the whim of fate, much like the waters of the river she watches over. Perhaps she hopes that in time it will cleanse her of a lifetime of sin, of banditry, of murder, of worse. Or perhaps she seeks only to live out her days in quiet damnation."
Huh.
Yeah. That's the kind of stuff you just stumble upon in
right.
this game. It's great. A proud son of Clearbrook, this fisherman, age 27, reads the winds and waters like an educated man of his letters, and could bring home a king's bounty every day if he saw fit. Out of love for the river, however, he takes only what he needs, and leaves that which he does not. It's a man standing by a river, so that's nice.
Yes.
That one's great. This is another, Clearbrook has a lot of good ones. This is a guy standing on a bridge. A man who worries over anything and everything. His fears include, but are not limited to, disgruntled neighbors, gangs of roving bandits, hordes of ravenous monsters, various natural disasters, otherworldly beings dwelling deep within the earth, whether or not it will rain on the morrow, the ephemeral nature of existence, that sinister-looking kid surely plotting to kill him, dot, dot, dot.
Okay, then.
This is so good. Alright, now we're in the town of Still Snow. I love this one. Age 9. A girl who braves the wintry cold to play outside every day. She throws snowballs at passerby she believes to be up to no good. The gods only know how true her aim is.
Great.
That is fantastic.
Yes, that one's very good.
Here's a 67-year-old man. An elderly man who lives with his wife. In their youth, they feared they would never be blessed with a child, and though one was eventually born to them, he died in an accident at sea. Despite their best efforts, they never had another, and have since taken to looking after the children of the town as their own.
That's a sad one.
That is. Like,
those other ones are funny. That one was sad.
That one's sad. But they all have this quality where, like, in two or three sentences, they, like, tell a life story.
Yeah.
And you're like, you just have to think about it for a second. Some of these are profound. This is the best one. This one, I tweeted out, you have to go back to an area you would have been to before and go like back around behind this mansion. I was looking for a specific treasure and I found this guy I hadn't talked to before. And I inquired of him and here's what I got. Age 23. This guard who spends all day staring at the sky might seem to be neglecting his duties, but nothing could be further from the truth. Rather, in gazing at the clouds drifting overhead and contemplating the banality of existence, he has awakened to the reality that he is a figment of a dead god's imagination.
It's very true. We all are.
That is beautiful. That is a short story in two sentences. That's great. That should be used in like writing classes. I love that. Seeing if there's any other good ones in here. A young man born and raised in this town, he regrets his misspent youth, which he himself has likened to water flowing aimlessly wherever the current takes it. This may be why he frequently pauses atop the bridge to reflect on life, or it may be his reluctance to go to work. I'll leave it there. I think those are great.
Those are very good.
I love this fucking game. That just, that little, like, attention to detail, because there are hundreds of those in the game. Mm-hmm. Like, every NPC has one of those. Not everyone you can interact with. Sometimes there's just people standing in town, but you can't talk to them. But everyone you can talk to has one of those. And it's just, it is a consistent delight. I'm still loving Octopath Traveler. It was a great game. The soundtrack is so good, it's stupid. You should play Octopath Traveler.
Cool.
All right. What's your other stuff, Sean?
My other stuff is I have had a revelation earlier today. I unearthed something fucking amazing. I am at, I think, issue 154 in The Amazing Spider-Man. And so I'm almost at your 160, Jonathan, that you got me.
Oh, good.
And in that process, you know, go back for the details of all this, of how I'm reading this for, that would be last week's episode, I think. My sense of where this podcast is so confused at this
episode
point.
Episode 247, yes.
Yeah. Where I detail all that. But anyways, like, long story short is I have digital versions of, or the original versions of the comics that critically have the original advertisements in them. And I saw an advertisement in one of them for something I had no idea existed. And luckily, one of those ads, because there's two versions of the ads. One is a Stan Lee version. One is a Spider-Man version. And it sent me on... This was actually not very hard to find, but it is still very obscure. But luckily you can get digital versions of this. What is called, lovingly here, the biggest rock event of the decade. I'm going to read from old Spider-Man himself here.
Okay.
Hi, rock fans. This is old Spider-Man himself talking at you. I'm here to tell you about the latest hit of the disco world, Reflections of a Rock Superhero, featuring super songs about your friendly neighborhood, you know who, Don't Dare Miss It. Some of the great songs include Highwire, Square Boy, Spider-Man, Gwendolyn, Dr. Octopus, and many more. In 1975, Jonathan, Stan Lee and Marvel Comics worked with a sort of like house band to create a rock concept album around Spider-Man called Spider-Man Reflections of a Rock Superhero with the art, like the cover art drawn by John Romita Sr., famous, you know, great Spider-Man artist that drew the Spider-Man issues from, like, issue 39 to, like, basically 100. And it is available online digitally. It's very easy to find. They did, like, a
it's
CD.
It's streaming.
Yeah, you can get streaming versions of it. And it's just, they made, because they made, like, a CD remaster of it sometime in the 2000s. And so you can just find this. You can also, if people just want to listen to it, you can easily find it on YouTube. It is so fucking amazing, Jonathan. I discovered this at about 3 o'clock this afternoon, and then immediately was like, bought it, downloaded it onto my phone, and just went for like an hour long walk around our neighborhood listening to it. It is a rock concept album. So it's not just like, here's a couple of like wacky songs vaguely connected to Spider-Man and superhero stuff. It is a full album with narration by Stan Lee in between the different tracks that are kind of connecting the connective tissue that tell a broad version of the story of Spider-Man, from him being bitten by the spider to Gwen Stacy dying, because this is a couple of years after Gwen Stacy's death. And so you have, like, there's a great song that's all about, like, the duality of being a superhero and of Peter Parker and Spider-Man and him, like, staring into the mirror. And I think the line is something like, Peter Parker stay, Spider-Man must go, or something. I think that's the title of the song. There's a whole song that's a flashback to him being in high school called Nobody Has a Crush on Peter. That is also very good. It's basically a 50s doo-wop song. There are two 50s doo-wop songs. That's a 50s doo-wop song. There's also Square Boy, which is a 50s doo-wop song, which has, like, Square Boy is the chorus line because he's a square. And that one also is a 50 doo-wop, and that tells basically the story of the first issue of Spider-Man.
Okay, they made a whole fucking Spider-Man musical, and they didn't just use this?
Yeah, right? That's exactly what I thought. Like, it's because it is extremely cheesy and funny and hilarious, but it's also legitimately pretty good. Like, you know, it's not fucking Dark Side of the Moon or anything. You know, it's not this incredible album, but it's also not terrible. It is in, like, kind of my wheelhouse of that, like, mid-1970s rock stuff. It's very, like... There's a lot of songs feel vaguely Pink Floyd-ish. There's a little bit like The Who, because actually a bunch of the songs are kind of like a little bit different genres of rock, and that's kind of fun, like the doo-wop stuff. Another great song is the Dr. Octopus song.
Part 1 and Part 2.
Yes, Part 1. I mean, Part 1 isn't really a Dr. Octopus. Like, the lyrics aren't about Dr. Octopus. It's setting up the Dr. Octopus song is Spider-Man having a dream about Dr. Octopus assembling a, like, army of super criminals. But Part 2, Dr. Octopus, is sung from the point of view of Dr. Octopus in this dream.
Well, Sean, we've now found the one way Sam Raimi's Spider-Man 2 could be better.
Right, yes. It's so good. It's so amazing. And then the Stan Lee narration in the middle is like the cherry on top. Especially because some of it is like legitimately pretty good, because I think there's one of the ones they have in earlier on in the album is him, I think, basically reading the narrative captions from like the last three panels of Amazing Fantasy 15, Spider-Man's first appearance, that culminates in the, you know, he learned that day that with great power must also come great responsibility, like that, where that line originally comes from. And he's just reading that out, which obviously he wrote those words originally. It's amazing. And people have to listen to it. It's so good.
I just added it to my Apple Music library. It is downloaded to my computer.
Good.
Also, the cover art for this thing
is really good.
Incredible. All I can think is, man, Marvel, this has to be the next Spider-Man movie. I want to hear Tom Holland singing to this shit.
Yes. Or at the very least, it needs to be like a DVD or Blu-ray bonus for yes. the next Spider-Man movie, is they do like a musical version of these songs, like The Wall movie or Tommy or something.
Right. That's got to be a poster at some point. Like, recreate that image with... Okay, I also like that Peter Parker looks like he's 30 in this, but, you know, whatever.
I mean, at this point, he's 1975, so he's almost graduated from college at this point.
Okay,
so,
that makes more sense.
He's got parachute pants in the whole 70s look, too. It's very good.
Yes, but man, it's he's hanging his head, looking in the mirror, hands behind his back.
And back at him is Spider-Man.
It's Spider-Man, the same and it's a big rant. He looks like he's in Aunt May's house, because it's like 30s architecture.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it's so good.
You have awakened us to two really cool things today, Sean.
Yeah. They're very different, but they are. I've had a very good day so far between watching episodes of Nichijou and listening to this insane album. It's so good.
And that advertisement was in the one I gave you.
Yes.
That's awesome. That is like weirdly serendipitous. Uh-huh. Awesome. All right. Well, I'm going to tell you guys about something awesome, too. This is the podcast where we're not talking about anything bad. We're talking about awesome shit.
Yeah.
It's awesome. So, Sean, I have discovered a new favorite director.
Okay.
And I brought the Blu-rays just for visual reference for myself. Have you ever heard, Sean, of a director named King Hu?
No, I have not.
Okay. King Hu, so if you don't know, this is a director who made wuxia films, which are Chinese martial arts films, specifically like period piece swordplay movies. There's a little more to it, but that's a good way to kind of describe
it.
And King Hu is sort of one of the main fathers of this genre cinematically. Wuxia goes back in literature hundreds and hundreds of years. Isn't Romance of the Three Kingdoms considered wuxia?
No, I don't think. Because I think wuxia has to have some sort of like vague fantasy kind of component. Like it's a bit over the top in terms of like at least certainly cinematic stylings. Because, like, I think Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon is definitely the most well-known version of it.
Sean, every one of these fucking movies I have says on the box somewhere, inspired Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
I'm sure, yeah.
So if you like that movie, you need to watch these films. Okay, so let me back up. So like I said, King Hu, father of the wuxia genre, starts directing in the 60s for Shaw Brothers in Hong Kong.
Okay, yes.
Quick thing to set up this conversation is give you, like, the 3-minute lecture on Chinese cinema. Which is not enough time.
No, yes.
But when people reference like Chinese films, they're actually not usually talking about mainland Chinese movies, because those have only been artistically significant for a fairly short period of time, like 20, 30 years. Mostly people know Hong Kong movies and Taiwanese movies.
Yeah.
And that's a whole political history that, we do not have time to get in here, and I don't know all that much about, but obviously... Hong Kong was a British colony for a very, very long time. It has re-entered Chinese hands, but it is still not run governmentally by the, like, you know, People's Republic of China. So that's Hong Kong. It's its own thing. It has developed its own cinematic language over the years. Taiwan is a separate entity that China wants to say is theirs. That's a whole thing. But because of that, Taiwan and Hong Kong have very long histories. Mainland China itself really does not come on the map as a national cinema until after the fall of, like, Mao Zedong. And the fifth generation filmmakers is what they're called in the 1980s, Zhang Yimou and people like that, who have gone on to be basically just commercial mainstays because that's been very much absorbed by, like, the communist government and the commercial powers that be in mainland China. But King Hu was working in Hong Kong and then most of his career in Taiwan, which is where all three of the movies I've seen of his come from. And in the 60s, when the wuxia film was really, like, becoming good, because there's a lot of time before then where it's very cheesy, not very well made. He makes this movie in the 60s with the Shaw brothers called Come Drink With Me, which I just ordered the DVD of because I have to go back and see that one, but I didn't know we had a DVD of it here. And then he went on to make some other movies, and this is why I'm talking about him now, is that earlier this decade, like 2014, 2015, the Taiwan Film Institute... yes, in other countries, governments support art. The Taiwan Film Institute commissioned restorations of three of his major movies. And those have been coming out on Blu-ray around the world in the years since. And they are, and I have all three of them, because I've been picking these up as they've come out. And the last one, Dragon Inn, just came out from Criterion like 2 weeks ago, and I got it in the sale at Barnes & Noble. And this is the earliest movie of his I have. So I got this, and I've been going forward. And I've now watched all three. And I have to talk about these, because like I said, one of my new favorite directors. So these came out in a different order, but the way they are, Criterion has Dragon Inn and A Touch of Zen. And then there's a third film called Legend of the Mountain that Kino put out over here. But the Blu-ray looks the same as the other two because, again, it was all restored in Taiwan. Dragon Inn came out in 1967. And this is the one that, like, Come Drink With Me really put him and kind of the new sense of the wuxia genre on the map. And then King Hu was, he felt he didn't have enough commercial freedom or creative freedom in Hong Kong, so he went to Taiwan and made this film. It actually should be called Dragon Gate Inn. It's one of those things where the Western title, they just took a word out of it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really understand that thing that we do with Western, but whatever. Dragon Gate Inn. And Sean, you would love this movie so fucking much, you have to watch it.
I'm sure.
Dragon Gate Inn, like I said, 1967, first one in Taiwan, and the whole setup is that it's Ming Dynasty, that's his favorite time to set movies, is in the Ming Dynasty. And there's a group of evil eunuchs, because there are always evil eunuchs in Chinese fiction.
Yeah, the Chinese government. No, not just in fiction, like literally in the Chinese government. Like, that's not made up for Romance of the Three Kingdoms. That shit happened.
Yes. And so there's a group of power-hungry eunuchs who there is a, like, the Secretary of Defense, however, whatever you would call him.
Yeah.
The, of, like, the Ming Dynasty at the time has pissed off the eunuchs, so they kill him, and they want to kill his family, but the family escapes. And they know they're heading for the border of northern China. So they send all these eunuch assassins out to wait at the Dragon Gate Inn for the family to pass so they can slaughter them. And a group of people, like, who want to protect the family converge at the Dragon Gate Inn as well. And most of the action of this 2-hour movie takes place in and around this amazing set that is the Dragon Gate Inn. This little rundown inn in not even countryside, you would say. It's like the fucking desert, northern China. And, it's so good, Sean. It's so good. There's an actor who's in all three of these movies named Shi Chun, who his introductory scene in Dragon Inn is he comes in after the bad guys have, like, taken over the inn, and he just walks in. It's a very kind of Toshiro Mifune kind of entrance of just, like, owning the space, but even kind of, like, quieter and calmer, because, like, he sits down and he orders wine and noodles, and it is, I shit you not, a full 20-minute sequence of him just fucking with the eunuchs at the Dragon Gate Inn before any of the big... We don't even know really who's who yet. And it's just a big 20-minute intro to this character. And then you meet the other people who are converging on the inn. And when the action breaks out in this one, my God, King Hu is one of the single best filmmakers in terms of just, like, cinematic grammar I have ever seen. It's true in all three of his movies. Like, you know how if you have a writer you love, you just like to read their prose? It doesn't so much matter what the story is. It's just like, I just love reading how they put words together. That's King Hu and, like, visual language, because he has this uncanny sense of, first and foremost, editing. These movies will remind you, if nothing else, that editing is the first and most important cinematic special effect. Because if you edit right, you can kind of do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Because he pioneered a lot of the visual language that would be used later on for, like, wire foo stuff, where you put people on wires, which is like what Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon does. But he didn't use wires. He used trampolines and good editing.
Good.
And it's so good. And some of the fight stuff in this, it's not like they're these, some of them are bigger, long, drawn out fights, but some of them, it'll just be like a move that someone does that is so fucking badass and amazingly realized on screen, I like have to pause it, rewind, and watch it 3 more times before I move on with the movie. Like in one part where I think it's Shi Chun stabs a guy through a door with his sword, backhanded, and it's amazing. There's so many good moments like that. It is such a cool movie. It was a, like, as it says here, a refinement that was new to the wuxia genre, breathed life into a, you know, classic genre, all this stuff. It's a really important, this was a huge hit in China. It was his only big hit. After this, he had a very troubled career commercially. But it is an amazing movie. You should see it. And it's the least of the three films I've watched.
Jeez.
Yeah. Least in two ways. One, it's only 2 hours. And the other two are both over 3.
Jesus.
So the second one, this is his most famous movie now, kind of like critically, although it was a flop when it came out in all the areas of China it released in. It's called A Touch of Zen. And this movie, Criterion put it out over here a year or two ago. I forget when I picked it up, but I had not watched it yet. And there was very much like, it was a big sensation around the world when it started getting shown again with this restoration, because it was very hard to see. Mm-hmm. It's true of all these. They were very hard to see in any kind of English language version before now. And A Touch of Zen is his masterpiece. It's the one that everyone like this is the movie of his you should see if you don't see any others. And it is crazy because it is a wuxia film. It is a, you know, swordplay kind of movie. It's got martial arts. It's got a lot of the hallmarks of the genre, like the sort of strong, mysterious woman who is sort of the driver of the plot. And there's kind of a weaker man who is the protagonist, but really he's our POV character for her. Those are some of the main things in these films. And But what it is A Touch of Zen, which is full 3 hours. It was released originally in two parts, kind of like Kill Bill. The Criterion version is just they've put it together. But it is kind of an art house wuxia film, is the way it's kind of described usually. Because the title, A Touch of Zen, is not like a... It is the Western title, but it's something King Hu selected. It's not a silly, like, oh, these people are Chinese, let's put the word Zen in the title.
Right.
Which I was worried when I started watching it. You know, that happens.
Yes.
And it's not, because while King Hu was not a devout Buddhist himself, he was really interested in Buddhist spirituality and Taoist spirituality and how this like kind of worked on the world and how he could portray it visually. So A Touch of Zen, the plot setup is really basic. It's you follow, Shi Chun is the kind of main male character again, and he is a very lazy scholar in a village who doesn't want to like go work for the government. And one day, the haunted house... The house they think is haunted near where he lives, someone has moved in there. He goes in, there's a great scary sequence of him like, you know, treading through the grounds. And it turns out there's this woman played by Su Feng, I think is her name. Yeah, Su Feng, who is a really cool person to learn about. She's an actor in this and Legend of the Mountain. She was a huge star and then retired in 1990, became a film producer and is instrumental in building Chinese national cinema. One of the films she produced you might have heard of is called Farewell, My Concubine. Okay, and then she also funded completely the restoration of these films. So she's really cool.
Yeah.
But anyway, she plays the main woman in this movie, and she is... Her family was also killed by the government eunuchs. And she is trying to escape them. So she's come to this village to kind of hide out from them, but then this mysterious warrior has come to the village to find her. He realizes who she is, and now they have hundreds of bad guys coming at them towards this small village, and it's just her, the Shi Chun character, and a couple of other characters who have to fight all these guys off. But it's more than that. The last 45 minutes of this movie basically just go martial arts avant-garde. There's no other way to describe it.
Okay.
Where, like, the normal warriors have, like, run their course and they can't beat the bad guys. So their Buddhist friends come in and start fucking with the bad guys and make them see the face of God. And you will understand what I mean if you see the movie. It's amazing. Like I said, it's 3 hours long. Every fucking second of that is earned. It is an incredible joy to watch. I had to take a break in the middle just to do stuff, not to like, I wasn't like bored with the movie. It's just, it's a long movie.
Yeah.
And it's incredible. The scene in the middle of the movie where it's just this giant fight in this bamboo forest is super famous. It inspired a similar scene in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon and a bunch of other stuff. And it's what the end of part one was in its original theatrical release. And the end of that sequence, how they defeat the bad guys in the bamboo forest, is one of those moments where you just gasp for air, rewind the movie, and see if you actually saw what you think you just saw. And the other thing to say about all of this, when I say how good a filmmaker he is, all of these movies are in, you know, anamorphic widescreen, big wide frames. Might be the best use of widescreen I've ever seen in films, is how King Hu shoots with those wide frames. He has these, like, amazing, I guess you would call them tracking shots or moving shots that are just impossibly fluid. Very much based in some of the stuff like Kurosawa and people were doing with samurai films, but taken to a whole other level in terms of camera movement. He uses visual language. The DVD for Legend of the Mountain compares it to Terrence Malick, and that's not a terrible comparison in terms of how much he will cut away to shots of nature, because 100% of these movies are location shoots, which is part of why he stopped making money at a certain point.
Right.
And it's just like visually these movies consistently, I would be watching them and have my jaw dropped where I don't know how they got the shot. That is a rare feeling for me these days of like, Mission Impossible Fallout has some of that.
Yes,
we're going to get to. But like usually it's, especially in modern cinema, it's you spent a lot of money and you got some CGI or something.
Yeah.
But even in classical cinema, I tend to know what the techniques are to get a crazy shot, even if I know it's like that was really hard or something. But with this movie, especially because it's all on location, so much of it has the precision of like a painting or an animated movie in terms of like how light comes through trees and where they have the mist running through things and just the specific compositions. I just can't believe they got it. The only downside of that for a modern viewer is that these are location movies from the 60s and 70s in Taiwan. Every inch of the dialogue is dubbed. You're going to hear that. Like, I don't mean dubbed in English.
ADR. It's like watching, like, a spaghetti western or something.
Yeah. So just, you know, it's you'll hear that in the soundtrack, especially because they're now cleaned up and everything. And some people I know get distracted by that. if you watch movies that are old enough, the sound film was not usually done on set for until like the 80s, reliably, you know? So, anyway, but yes, Touch of Zen, amazing fucking movie, and that scene in the forest, Jesus Christ. Then maybe my favorite.
Okay.
Is Legend of the Mountain, which is a full 192 minutes.
That's a long movie.
This one is 1979, so this is 8 years after A Touch of Zen. This is a movie he made in Korea. It's set in China, but shot in Korea because there was a Korean tax break he was able to use. He actually shot two movies at the same time. This is we don't have the other one. It's called Raining in the Mountain. That has not come out here, but this
was
one
King is King Hu basically the Chinese Orson Welles?
At a certain point, yes, he was. He could not get stuff made, and when he did, he had to like scrimp and save and cheat for it.
Huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then this Legend of the Mountain is his last significant movie. He did a little bit after this, but like one of the two movies he did after this one, I don't think he even finished, or someone else finished it for him. He just could not get funded, and then he died young at like 64. Sean, I'm going to say some words here that's going to make you want to take this Blu-ray out of my hand and watch it right now.
Okay, yeah, because it's already, I'm feeling that for the other two already, so.
This is a Chinese gothic horror film.
Okay, fuck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm not, like, I'm not soft-selling that. This is a Chinese gothic horror film. The plot of Legend in the Mountain is Shi Chun, once again our main character, is a scholar who needs some money, so he agrees to copy some Buddhist sutras. And because of the way these sutras work, he cannot just do that any old place. They have to send him to a sacred, quiet place. So he is sent far up this mountain to this mysterious home that is near an old war base that has since been abandoned because this is actually set during the Song Dynasty, which was a less secure period of Chinese history. And so there's not many people there. And along the way, he starts seeing ghosts. And then he gets to the house and weird things start happening. He does not really know what's going on, and it is 3 hours of him, you know, trapped in, and then all these crazy things going on with basically a bunch of ghosts in the mountains of China, and it is 100%, I don't know if this is the right term for it, but Chinese gothic horror. There's probably a Chinese term for that, but
yes.
You know.
But I know what you mean, yeah, especially with like the trapped in the house thing, yeah.
And it is so good, Sean, it is so amazing. Su Feng is in this one as well, she plays the female lead. Who he gets entangled with. I don't even want to spoil. This is a movie from 1979, but I'm not spoiling the plot. It's so good.
Yeah.
And all I'll say is this one is not a wuxia film. It is a kind of horror-styled film, so it does not have martial arts stuff in it. What it does have is magical battles that are conducted with hand drums.
Okay.
And if that doesn't make sense, it will when you watch this movie. About halfway through this one, there is a 10 to 15 minute sequence where a Buddhist lama is trying to get rid of one of the ghosts, and both of them are playing drums at one another, but they are not on screen together. It's done all through editing and sound, and it is one of the single most impressive pieces of filmmaking I've ever seen, and that's like the first of three of those in this movie, because there are a lot of drum battles. Good Legend Lord. Of the Mountain is so good, and I'll tell you, if you don't want to pick up like the Criterion Blu-rays, Touch of Zen and Dragon Inn are on Filmstruck on the Criterion channel, mm-hmm. So you can get those easily. I don't know if Legend of the Mountain is streaming anywhere. It's Kino. They don't have a streaming service, but you could buy it on Amazon or iTunes or something. Or this Blu-ray is really cheap. It's like $12. And it's got a cool reversible cover, because you're seeing the cover that is the original Chinese poster. Yeah. That's what came with the thing. So I flipped it around, because this looks so much better.
Yes.
Yes, Chinese like watercolor poster. These movies are so amazing. I'm not doing justice to them here. I've really discovered someone. I've been going into like full scholar mode, and I already have books on reserve at the University of Iowa Library, so I can read more about King Hu. I'm not there yet, but I'm going to pick up those books. And I hope we get more of his movies here. We also have, like I said, Come Drink With Me, which is his 1966 Shaw Brothers movie. That came out on DVD in the mid-2000s and is still in print. So I just got that in today, but I haven't watched it yet. And I don't know if the Taiwan Film Institute is planning on remastering any more of his films, because the ones that we have are in, I mean, these are in good condition now, but none of these had been in well-preserved condition. As you might imagine. So it's nice that these are being saved. These three are all like major works of world cinema. You would do well to watch any of these. I hope we get more of them. Taiwan is a cool country for cinema. Like, I don't think I've seen one Taiwanese movie I don't like. Other than that, You could throw a dart at all the Taiwanese movies I've seen, and any one of them would be one of the best films I've ever seen. They have a very rich cinematic history. This is even before like the new Taiwanese cinema movement that a lot of people now would know from the 80s, like Edward Yang and Hu Hsiao-hsien and things like that. It's very cool. It's even gotten me to download an app on my phone to learn a little bit about the Chinese language.
There you go.
Because I'm just fascinated.
Yep.
Much easier than Japanese in a lot of ways.
There, yeah. It's
harder to pronounce grammatically and linguistic, like how it's written is much easier.
Yeah.
Because there are more kanji, but they each mean one syllable, which is nice. So anyway, yeah, this is my new obsession.
Cool. Well, I now have tabs on my phone for all those, and I will look into it, figure out how I want to go with those in the near future.
At least watch, like, because these first two are on Filmstruck. They're so easy to get.
Yeah.
You should just watch those. They're so good. Dragon Inn is a perfect place to start, and because it's also not 3 hours long, which is a better way to, like, ease yourself in.
Yeah.
But, man, oh, man, I want to talk with you about these. Kind of especially Legend of the Mountain, Sean, because I know that would so be your jam.
Yeah, sounds like it.
Yeah. Anyway, so those are some Chinese movies.
Cool.
Let's briefly talk about American cinema. Before we talk about Mission Impossible.
Yes, other examples of American cinema.
But. Let's talk about the death of American cinema, also known as Disney.
Yes, the rises of the mega corporations that will eventually rule cyberpunk America in the near future.
All right, so guys, if you didn't hear the news, this is our one piece of news this week. The merger between, I don't even know if merger's the right word, it's really an acquisition of Fox into Disney has been finalized. It's going to happen. Shareholders signed off on it. The government signed off on it because we don't enforce antitrust laws anymore.
Yeah.
It's not going into effect until 2019, and I don't think it's finalized when all of that is going to happen. But yes, Fox is going to be absorbed into Disney. And that's not good.
No.
It's not good in just about any way. Like if you make the pro-con list, the pro list is X-Men might get to show up in Marvel movies.
Yeah, X-Men and Fantastic Four.
Yeah. The con list is the death of American cinema. Because the Disney's consolidation has been going on for a while. Like, obviously Disney is one of the oldest still surviving movie studios in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Because they go back to the fucking 1910s, I think. Or maybe 20s. But, like, obviously Walt Disney was working through all of that. But they have been making specific consolidation moves. You know, there was Pixar in the mid-2000s, and everyone thought, oh, that makes sense. You know, Pixar's been working with Disney all this time. Might as well come into the fore.
It's animated movies, so it's like part of their brand, basically. Yeah.
It didn't mean Disney stopped making their own animated movies. In fact, their animated movies got much better because Pixar talent came aboard and helped them there. So, like, that was like, no one thought that was bad.
Yeah.
Then a couple years later, they buy Marvel. And that's a little bit like, okay, that's a lot of characters to own Disney, but you know, Marvel had been searching for a, like, corporate home. They had been distributing through Paramount, but they were basically an independent studio. And it was like, okay, you know.
Yeah, like, Marvel, like, the comic side of Marvel had also been in, like, dire straits on and off since the 90s. And so, like,
it's like, this makes sense. Like, it's a diversification for Disney beyond just, like, kids stuff that makes, I mean, Marvel is kids stuff, but you know what I mean. Like, maybe older kids stuff. It's like, okay, that makes sense. And then they buy Lucasfilm, and then we're all like, okay.
Yeah.
This might be going too far. Now you own all the Disney stuff we know, all the Pixar stuff, every superhero that anyone cares about who's not Batman or Superman or Wonder Woman, and you now own Star Wars, Indiana Jones, and Howard the Duck. This is crazy.
They own both sides of Howard the Duck. Duck, the Marvel comic book, and Howard the Duck, the fucking movie.
Exactly. So now we're all like, okay, I don't know how to feel about this. And since then, we've started to see the repercussions where Disney is like, I think the stat earlier this year with Incredibles 2 was they were number one at the box office, like more than half the weeks of this year so far.
Yeah. I mean, we had a big conversation around Solo, A Star Wars Story, when we talked about that movie, about how it is impossible for them to release movies because all their movies compete with all their other movies.
At this point, yes, because they've had two instances this year where their own movies have eaten their own other movies with A Wrinkle in Time got kind of swallowed up by Black Panther, and Solo got swallowed up by Infinity War and Deadpool 2, which will soon be a Disney property.
Right, yes, so, Jesus Christ.
So, like, all of these things are Disney. It's like every month at least, Disney has one major tentpole. Sometimes they have more than one. They are dominating the landscape. And it is just this massive push towards the corporate consolidation of filmmaking. Now they're going to own Fox. And this is not one where I'm seeing anyone have the, like, benign explanation for this. This is just, like, the scary side of corporate consolidation.
Yeah.
Because, honestly, like, the thing is, to me, this isn't even really about getting Fox's IP stuff, because the only thing they would care about there is the Marvel stuff, like Fantastic Four, which they could have gotten in a different kind of deal.
Yes, yeah, the same way they got Spider-Man from Sony.
The reason to do this is to take Fox out of the picture, have fewer movies on the calendar every year, and they don't have to worry about the competition. Like, that's the reason you buy Fox. It's not so that, like, Disney is super excited to make Die Hard 6 or whatever we're on. And it's just scary because we're already in a mode where in the film theory stuff, like the transnational cinema that America is a part of and is eating, you know, in terms of just, you know, American movies are made with a size scale budget that means they cannot in any way recoup their finances in the United States.
Yeah.
So like worldwide transnational releases are everything to studios now, and it means fewer movies are being made, not just in America, but worldwide. More and more resources are going into fewer and fewer productions. It is a chokehold on cinema in the United States, obviously, which has never had a national cinema. Like, that's an important distinction in, like, film theory terms, that I talked about, like, Taiwanese national cinema, the new Taiwan cinema movement in the 1980s. We've never had something like that in America, partially because we don't have any government, like, Ministry of Culture sort of thing. But we also have such an immense corporate consolidation of film power that there are modes where we kind of... There are moments in time where American cinema feels like it's maybe becoming a national cinema, like the 70s, but it never lasts for that long, and it then becomes a very commercialized cinema. Which, I'm not saying, like, if you like commercial movies, that's, we talk about them all the time, we're about to talk about a bunch of them. But, like, that's not the bad thing. But it is this larger trend of, so more and more resources, fewer and fewer productions, throttling cinema at home, in some ways throttling cinema around the world, because these movies eat up box office in other parts of the world too, and make it harder for other countries to make their own movies and extend their own national cinemas. And so the Fox thing is a big part of that, because Fox was a major, you know, multinational competitor. Now there will be, I mean, the estimates that we're seeing are like 20 to 30 fewer major film releases a year. This is not Disney is going to make as many movies as Fox made. They're going to make what they want to make. And because, again, Fox is just not going to be a thing anymore. That's what's going to happen, is the Fox logo is going away. And, you know, Fox is one of the oldest movie studios. They have a long history. I'm personally very worried about what happens to Fox's catalog. Because I don't know, something tells me that there's not going to be like a really well curated tab on the new Disney streaming app of like classic Fox, you know, early sound films.
Right.
You know? So Criterion, you've got your work cut out for you now with that side of things, except Disney's never cut a deal with Criterion. So I don't know what's going on with that. I don't know. It's a scary thing, especially I think just for the future of cinema. Like, clearly Disney is one of the many corporations in America that needs to be broken up.
Oh, yes, yeah. Like, we talked about Time Warner, like, or addressed it a little bit with the internet stuff.
And again, we've talked about this before. I think the way Disney gets away with it to some degree is that they're becoming very monopolistic, but they are not in a bunch of different industries. They make movies, right? And they sell toys and stuff. But Disney does not also have a telecom company. It does not sell you internet. And it does not do those sorts of things. And so our ire is not raised at it the same way a Time Warner is. And I do think it's a much less harmful corporation because of that. But within the specific industry of cinema, we're watching a potentially unbeatable monopoly being formed. And that's just it's a scary and artistically, it's an untenable future for cinema. Not just artistically, like commercially, it might be good for Disney. That the industry will not survive a Disney this big.
Yeah, it does. It's weird to think, like, what are going to be the effects of this, you know? It's just like, I can't think of many other examples of something like that. Maybe, like, the only other examples I can think of like, companies, like, a single or a couple of companies, like, owning some, like, a whole industry like that is actually comic books. And, like, DC and Marvel, particularly once DC started acquiring, like, their huge back catalog of stuff. See our insane conversation about Captain Marvel / Shazam around San Diego Comic-Con. But yeah, like, once Marvel got like really big and became what Marvel is in the Silver Age, and then DC to kind of combat that bought a bunch of whole old characters, which is how like the Watchmen like kind of thing happened, that kind of stuff. That then the comic book industry was basically dominated by two companies, and you kind of had like Dark Horse there, and like Image came up as an independent comic publisher. But like you can look at the state of the comic book industry compared to how it was in the 70s and 60s, and certainly compared to how it was in the 30s. Like when we call the 30s the golden age of comic books, we mean that because Action Comics number one, the first appearance of Superman, sold millions of copies. Comic books do not sell millions of copies today. And we have millions of more people, hundreds of millions of more people in the population of the United States.
Also, every comic book property is much, much more visible than it ever has been.
And but still, the comic book industry itself and like selling comic books and marketing comic books and creating comic books is like has been stuck in a rut for decades at this point. And I think part of that is because it has been controlled by two massive corporations that do not know how to compete with each other well and don't know how to like diversify their own like lineup and get new blood in and get like new people interested in the medium. Like I think movies are more culturally dominant, so there's not going to necessarily be that bad, but it is, I'm curious to see if it will have a similar effect.
Well, one effect I absolutely think is going to happen is the indie and art house film effect. Disney does not, has never had, at least in my lifetime, any sort of art house outreach. They do not have any, they do not have a label. Well, in my lifetime, actually, they would have. They would have had Miramax, which became the Weinstein Company. The long story, but, you know. And Miramax would have done some of that. Obviously, Miramax is very important in the 90s and, like, the new American independent wave of, like, people like Quentin Tarantino and stuff like that. But since they divested Miramax and that the Weinsteins went off on their own to sexually harass another day, Disney has not had any kind of art house presence like that. And they have not had any kind of outreach to independent filmmakers, to smaller budget productions, because they don't need it. You know, Disney can release Infinity War and a couple other big movies and they will make more than enough profit for a year. And there is no financial incentive whatsoever to spend $5 million on a little movie and make $40 million on it, which is a really solid, it's actually a huge profit margin. But that $35 million is couch change to them. Fox is a company that has had some big franchises, but they have not been, again in my lifetime, as commercially dominant as Disney. They might have a couple of big hits a year, but to get them through the year, they have these other arms. So 20th Century Fox themselves might release big, you know, smaller movies, but they also had Fox Searchlight, which is a really important, Fox Searchlight as a brand is one of the best things that's happened to cinema in the last 20, 30 years. And just, if you don't believe me, look at the Best Picture Oscar nominee list every year and count how many are Fox Searchlight releases. A lot of them are. And Fox Searchlight did a lot of that work. And Disney is not going to have any interest in that. I cannot imagine a world in which Disney cares one iota about that, because the, you know, secondhand toy sales from Avengers Infinity War are going to make more than Lady Bird ever could.
Right.
Or whatever movie. I think Lady Bird was Fox Searchlight. If not, throw a dart at a, you know, recent art house movie and you would get a Fox one. So, like, it is a scary thing on that level. There's going to be, I think, a major squeeze to independent and art house cinema, which was not the case with Disney buying, like, Marvel and Lucasfilm, because they didn't make, you know, there wasn't an indie Marvel brand, you know?
Right, yeah.
But there was, there is for Fox. That's probably going to go away. There's not, there's less and less capital for people to pick up the slack elsewhere, but there's also just less room on the schedule where you can get your movie into theaters and have it have the word of mouth where it's going to survive when there's a big release every couple weeks, increasingly from Disney.
Yeah.
And it's also squeezing out other studios, because all these, because other studios haven't been playing that Disney game. Like, we're going to talk about Paramount later, makes the Mission Impossible movies. That's kind of their, that and Transformers are their last two big franchises that they have. And so Paramount is another company that releases a lot of smaller stuff. You know, Warner Brothers even has a lot of big stuff, but they also release more adult movies here and there that aren't going to make $1 billion or things like that. But those companies are increasingly feeling the squeeze because they're competing with Disney, who doesn't have to do that stuff. So what they want, what, you know, Paramount wants is Mission Impossible, but making $1 billion a movie, you know, and it doesn't do that. These just aren't those kinds of movies.
Yeah.
And so they're probably going to search for that and search for that. And one day they're going to cut a franchise like Mission Impossible, which is not the highest of art, but is, I think, much better made more consistently than a lot of, like, the Disney stuff. they're going to cut that loose for something that is a more tried and true, you know, billion-dollar franchise.
Yeah.
Even TV is getting in on this with, like, Amazon doing Lord of the Rings and shit like that. So this is part of a... I mean, this is a larger story about America in general, is the corporate consolidation in America, which either will be addressed or America's not going to survive.
Yeah.
Those are the two options. There is not an America that survives as a functioning democracy with corporations this big and powerful. There just isn't. So either, you know, President Bernie Sanders breaks... I'm kidding. Whoever, you know, a good liberal president would be, breaks up, you know, all these corporations, or we're fucked.
Yeah.
Like, that's kind of the two options. So, yeah, Disney's part of that. I don't know.
It's going to be really weird when those X-Men movies come out, huh? Because there still are those two. There's, like, what, New Mutants and then X-Men Dark Phoenix?
Yeah. Dark Phoenix will come out before the thing this goes through, I think, because they have that schedule, I think, for February 2019. I wonder if New Mutants ever comes out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because that one already got delayed like a year, right?
And it got another delay past that. So, like, it's pushed way back past this deal. And I think that that one might just get... I don't know. It's rare for a movie like that to truly not get a release. But I don't know. Maybe it gets sold to Netflix or something.
Yeah, or they just show it on their own fucking streaming service.
That's honestly, that's probably it. Yeah. I don't know. So, anyway, dark times.
It's weird.
Let's talk about some good movies.
Okay.
Because, again, and so let's go from bemoaning corporate consolidation to these are a product of corporate consolidation. But the Mission Impossible movies do, I think, have, especially for, like, there has been, like, this rediscovery over the last couple of years as people started realizing, like, hey, these have all been really good consistently for years now. And people realizing, oh, this might be Hollywood's most consistent, like, franchise.
Yeah.
And sort of, like, in the action film space, some of the most cinematically interesting as well. Also, they're just fun, which is mm-hmm. nice. The Mission Impossible movies.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a strange franchise. Like, it is pretty unlike any other one I can think of.
Oh, completely. I mean, Fallout just set the record for, like, biggest box office opening for the franchise. 22 years and 6 films into its existence. It's also got the best reviews of anything in the franchise. I don't think there's anything remotely comparable to that. The closest would be, like, James Bond. But James Bond obviously also changes its casts and its crews with every other film. And it has high periods and low periods. And there's no real clear, like, it's a sine wave of quality.
Right,
it's
yeah.
not a linear chart or anything like that. So yeah, these movies, you're absolutely right. This is a weird ass fucking franchise, but it's also really good.
It's really good. One of the things that is interesting about the new one is that when you, like, the history of the franchise was we make, like, one movie about every 5 years and they all had a different director.
Yeah.
Up till 5 with Christopher Quarry, who then came back for 6 and then, like, you know, 2 or 3 years is what it's been
3 years since yeah. 5.
Three since 5, and then, like, most of the supporting cast from that movie are back. It's got a directly connected plot. But other than this, like, the most recent example, they have all been, like, maybe, like, Ving Rhames shows up for at least a cameo in all of them. Simon Pegg is in 3 and 4. You know, they kind of address the wife character from 3 and 4 a little bit. It's like there are little bits of tiny connection, but generally, Mission Impossible 1, 2, 3, and 4, and then ignoring 6, 5, are all, like, fucking different movies, like, very different movies, but they do have a certain core Tom Cruise-ness, and they have the fucking Mission Impossible TV show theme in them, and so there's, like, enough of connective material to make them feel like they're all part of the same franchise, but it evolves so much with each individual entry.
Yeah, it had always been 4 to 6 years between movies. It was 4 between 1 and 2, 6 between 2 and 3, 5 between 3 and 4, and then 4 between 4 and 5. So it was always these really big gaps, as you say, a different filmmaker for each of the first 5. I do think, like, Mission Impossible 3 snaps something into place where, like, I mean, you get Simon Pegg, you get more of a team dynamic, like, Tom Cruise feels like he's playing a human being this time, and, like, the characterization of Ethan Hunt is roughly in all of 4, 5, and 6 what he did in 3. So, like, some of that carries through. But it's still, like, Brad Bird does not direct his movie like J.J. Abrams did. Chris McQuarrie does not do his like Brad Bird did.
Yeah.
And, like, these are all big names, too, which I think is interesting. Like, you know, Brian De Palma did the first one, and he was already Brian De Palma, obviously. Yes. He was actually on his way out of being Brian De Palma, because that's probably the last movie he made that anyone knows about. And then in 2000, of course, you had Mission Impossible 2 by John Woo.
Yes.
See John Woo. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. It's a bad movie, but it's wonderful.
It's great. I love it.
It transcends good, bad. Yes. It's a thing. And then you have J.J. Abrams. That was his first movie, which is easy to forget, but it was...
Right. I remember reading that he got to direct the movie because Tom Cruise liked Alias. Is that basically the story?
I think that's it. It's also why he left Lost very early on, is because he went to direct Mission Impossible 3, and then, like... It's weird. Mission Impossible 3 is by far the lowest grossing, and it was actually had very mixed reception when it was released, which I think is weird because it's really good.
Mm-hmm.
But it, like, built Bad Robot as a film brand, and, like, I think...
Yeah, because Bad Robot's also a production arm on all of these, right?
Since 3, yeah. It was previously just Tom Cruise and his old producing partner, Paula Wagner, and now it's Tom Cruise and the Abrams people. But yeah, so it not only put J.J. Abrams and his whole production company on the map, but then reshaped the franchise. So you have J.J. Abrams, who was an up-and-comer, I guess you would say. Brad Bird, who was not an up-and-comer, he was very well-established, but he'd only done animated movies, so Ghost Protocol is his first live-action film. I'd say he acquitted himself pretty well on that count.
Yeah.
And then Christopher McQuarrie, who is kind of an interesting character because he's been a screenwriter forever. He wrote The Usual Suspects and won an Oscar for it. And he'd written a few movies like that over the years. Did not direct... he directed a movie in the early 2000s that is like kind of a cult classic, but I forget what that one is. And then he was not allowed to direct again until the early 2000s with Jack Reacher, Tom Cruise film. And then Tom Cruise brought him over for Mission Impossible, and that's clearly a match made in heaven. And I think Christopher McQuarrie, I think we're going to see big things from him in the future. Yeah. I don't think that's a bold proclamation after Fallout. But,
One thing I really like about McQuarrie, because especially after watching 5 and then 6, I got obsessed with watching interviews of, the people involved in these movies. Because the production behind these movies is so fascinating. I love everybody calls him McHugh. And it's so good. All the actors, Simon Pegg, Tom Cruise, Rebecca Ferguson, everyone just calls him McHugh. It's such a good nickname. So I can only think of him as McHugh from now on.
That's good. All right. But the thing... So you've had all those different directors. Of course, the thing that stays the same is Tom Cruise, obviously.
Yeah.
His hair does not stay the same.
No.
But he is Tom Cruise. And it's not just... And this is the important part. Is it's not just Tom Cruise acts in these movies. He is the lead producer on these films. And he's not a producer who gets that credit out of, a vanity thing. He is hiring the director. He's hiring the screenwriter. If he doesn't like something, it's not happening. He is a very powerful producer on these films.
I mean, one of the things that I think is a pretty good... he doesn't direct, so that's one of the major things that's different. But Tom Cruise very much feels like an American Jackie Chan. Back in Jackie Chan's Hong Kong heydays.
Yeah.
Again, Jackie Chan did direct a lot of his movies also. But where Jackie Chan was involved in the production, obviously the main character. And the movie exists... existed off the back of Jackie Chan. He came up with the bones of the story. Sometimes he was involved directly with the screenwriting. But then obviously all of the action, all the stunts, how the action set pieces are created and choreographed and shot and edited, Jackie Chan had a hand in all of those. And that very much feels more or less what Tom Cruise is on these movies.
Yeah, and it's interesting because there are very few actors who are that powerful behind the scenes in Hollywood. And the Mission Impossible series exists out of the will of Tom Cruise to run another day. That's it. Mission Impossible 1 and 2 were really huge hits, especially by 90s box office standards. I mean, both broke half a billion. The 90s, that was... That'd actually be a flop today.
But back then, yeah.
Yeah, that's huge. Mission Impossible 3 kind of underperformed relative to that, but then they've gotten even bigger with the new ones. So there are points where I think... I don't think Mission Impossible 3 intrinsically, had to be made after 2, because just franchises didn't work like that back then. But, Tom Cruise has wanted to keep these movies going. I think in that Jackie Chan way, it's this series, for whatever reason, allows him to do the things he likes to do on screen.
Yeah.
And, he has tried to create other franchises for him to do that, Live, Die, Repeat, what's it called? Edge of Tomorrow.
Edge of Tomorrow.
Very
good movie.
Very good movie, but we'll not get a sequel.
No.
Edge of Tomorrow, Jack Reacher, things like that. But Mission Impossible is the one that has had actual, thrust behind it over the years. So these movies exist because Tom Cruise wants them to exist, And he's kind of like, he's kind of like willed them to be better over time. Because again, he's not just hired to do these movies. It's who's a filmmaker I think is going to be interesting for this. Who's a writer I think could create a good story.
What kind of crazy shit do I want to do? Like, what do I not, I don't know how to fly a helicopter yet. Let's do that in the next one.
Mission Impossible 3, I was reading about this. This is fascinating. Almost went into production twice before the J.J. Abrams version. And one, I forget who the second director was, but one of them was, it was David Fincher, was going to do it.
Jesus, that'd be a very different movie.
Yes. I think they made the right movie eventually, but like that's why it took 6 years to come out, is they kept trying and kind of it wasn't working. So, you know, the elephant in the room, Tom Cruise is a weirdo in real life.
Yeah, we all know like, it. The Scientology thing is a big sticking point.
It is. It's gross. I don't even know quite what to say about it. Because it's also like, we only know Tom Cruise's role in Scientology secondhand at this point. Because he does not talk about it. Like he, around the time of Mission Impossible 3 is like the one time he was open about his Scientology stuff. And it was weird. And we knew it was weird. And he knew it was weird. And so he's never talked about it again.
Yeah.
So he is a very big enigma in that way. And I just, I genuinely don't know what to make of him. Because you don't get this far in Hollywood being a tremendous, like, weirdo asshole the way you think he must be just from the Scientology stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, see the career of Johnny Depp. Eventually it falls apart. Clearly directors like working with him. Clearly other actors tolerate him.
Yeah, that's like,
I don't,
that was one of the things of why I watched all those interviews and stuff after watching these movies, was I was just so fascinated by, because like, you know, I've seen Tom Cruise movies, obviously. You know, I've seen quite a few Tom Cruise movies, and I've liked him quite a few movies. But I've never, like, been a Tom Cruise guy. Like, that was only ever, like, I see a movie and, like, Edge of Tomorrow happened to have Tom Cruise in it. I didn't go see the movie because of Tom Cruise, you know? And so watching these Mission Impossible movies was the most, like, concentrated Tom Cruise I've ever seen, of, like, watching a bunch of movies with Tom Cruise in it. Like, back after back, like, right in a row. I've never done that with any of his movies, because I've just never had. And it got me really interested in that, because, like, yes, like, there's a lot of weird shit behind the scenes, and particularly from that, like, mid-2000s period, from what I read. But every time you see an interview with him, or anybody ever talking about them, he seems like the nicest fucking person on the planet. Like, legitimately so nice, it's crazy.
And, you know, he is an actor, so
of course, yeah,
that could all be an act. I don't know. He could be one of those guys who just doesn't have a personality outside of his work, which happens a lot.
I mean, he seems like a mega workaholic, for sure.
Kind of like Peter Sellers-esque, honestly, in some ways. Like, they don't do similar styles of acting, but just, like, no one knew who Peter Sellers was off-screen because he kind of wasn't anyone, you know? Yeah, I don't know. It's really weird. Like, Scientology is a gross cult that does really exploitative stuff to people. I also think that describes pretty much every religion on earth to a T, but whatever. At a certain point, not every sect of every, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's weird. It's genuinely like hard to figure out what to say about it, because, you know, the Scientology stuff is bad, but again, no one he works with on movies has ever said he's done anything bad, so.
Yeah, there's never been any specific accusations that I know of that are like, oh, he, like, did this horrible thing.
The biggest thing I do know of is that, and this is detailed in the Alex Gibney film Going Clear, which is the Scientology doc for HBO. Obviously it is, it's an anti-Scientology side of the story, so that's what you're getting. I don't know what the pro side would be, but whatever. And it's an interesting film, and what they get into there, because Tom Cruise wouldn't talk to them, is that, you know, the Scientology people, like, it's not clear how involved he is with the, like, religion of Scientology.
Yeah.
Like, if he's day-to-day devout, I don't know. He was, I think, in the mid-2000s, but it's been a long time and he doesn't talk about it. But the Scientology people at the top of the ladder, like, really like having him. He's their spokesman. He gets them money, and they shower him with money and privilege and this stuff. You know, they have bought him houses and things like that. There is also the side of Scientology that fewer people know about called Sea Org, which is Sea Organization. It's because L. Ron Hubbard was a fucking crazy person and he tried to make a tax haven on his yacht offshore, and that's where that comes from, where they get, like, lower-level, non-rich Scientologists into it, and they go into Sea Org basically as unpaid labor, and Tom Cruise has used Sea Org for, like, house expansions and things like that, and that's a very exploitative thing.
Yeah.
That's the, like, gist of what I know in terms of, like, direct tie-ins to, like, bad things he's done Scientology-adjacent. But I don't know. It's a tough conversation to have.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, luckily there has not yet been a point in the movies where Tom Cruise turns to Ving Rhames and says, Ving, I think your thetan levels are a little low.
Right, yeah. That will be the last Mission Impossible movie when Ethan Hunt actually goes rogue and really is against the government and trying to take the government down like they think he is doing in all these movies, but he actually isn't.
Yeah. I don't know. It is weird because I think what you're saying about if you carved off the Scientology thing and knew nothing about that, or like let's say Scientology was secret and we didn't know what it was,
right?
You would just assume Tom Cruise was like one of the best guys in Hollywood,
yeah.
And so the two sides of it don't add up. It's not a Johnny Depp situation where like everything is fucked with that guy,
uh-huh.
And people don't even like working with him, but studios think he's bankable, so like they put him in their movies. So I don't know. It's very weird. It's very weird.
Yeah.
But he's a really good actor.
Yeah, he's a really good actor. And there's something that, like, I cannot help but deeply admire his commitment to what he does in these movies. Of going all the way and doing the practical stuff and learning how to do the stunts and doing the stunts. And, like, you know, like, again, like, it's the kind of Jackie Chan thing of this commitment to that sort of craft of stunt filmmaking that's, like, the dude fucking risks his life, like literally, seriously risks his life every time he makes one of these movies.
Yeah, I mean, and he's also just, I like the character, I like the performance. Like Ethan mm-hmm. Hunt is a, like he's kind of a blank in some ways, but he's a blank they've built onto so much at this point that like, he's genuinely a compelling figure to follow, you know?
Yeah.
He's in more of the like Captain America mold or something of like, he is not an ethically compromised character, but that's, I like that. I like that a lot. He's not Jack Bauer, you know, he's not torturing people.
Yeah, he's not like super conflicted and tortured. Like he's a very straight edge, like I just go and I get the mission done.
And Tom Cruise plays that very well. And when they won it, like in 5 and 6, when they've gone into more of the character focused stuff, it works. Mm-hmm. And that's a testament to that the performance, the character as it's been molded over time. You know, the fact that we've forgotten Mission Impossible 2 happened in this continuity, you know.
Again, I just want to flashback to what Ethan's life was in the early 2000s, and it's just Mission Impossible. Like, they even get John Woo to make it.
That'd be great. What I did hope, that just going ahead to Fallout for a second, there's a moment, this isn't really a spoiler, where Ving Rhames says to someone, there are two women Ethan has ever cared about, and he talks about Julia, his wife, from film 3. Knew we were going to get that. She's in the trailer, it's not a spoiler.
Yeah.
But I was hoping he was going to say something akin to like, and the Tandy Newton character in Mission Impossible 2, and like get a flashback to that. It was like, he really cared about her.
Yeah, like he went really far for that lady.
He maybe went too far in a lot of ways, because he risked a lot to try to save that woman's life.
Yep, and never saw her again.
Apparently, yes.
Cut her out of his life like he cut that hair.
Yes. I want Ving Rhames to say that line in the movie. Ethan, oh, same old Ethan. He cuts women out of his life like he cuts his hair.
Yep, it's. I do like the track of Ethan Hunt hair. That's like he has his like what you think of as Tom Cruise hair in Mission Impossible 1. Then just like full glorious like early 2000s like Superman mullet look fucking thing in Mission Impossible 2. Then it's sheared back a little bit to like a more sort of like conservative. It's still longish hair. But it's not, you know, that long in Mission Impossible 3. And by the time he gets to Mission Impossible 4, he's gone through such an arc, he's back to Tom Cruise hair again.
Yes.
Like, he's arrived back at where he started, but, like, it's much stronger and more mature looking. He doesn't look like a baby.
Yes. All right, let's talk about the individual movies.
Yes.
All right, Mission Impossible, we did Mission Impossible 1 and 2 last week, so we'll do a quick recap of those. Mission Impossible 1, I think, is an okay script, but it is so ludicrously well made by Brian De Palma and everyone involved that it is not just a blast to watch, but kind of a dead genre at this point of just like a very slick, smart, adult spy thriller, but still fun. It still lets itself have an adventure on a bullet train at the end.
Yes, it has a helicopter and a fucking train, like a tunnel. You know?
Which again, especially after Fallout, the most distracting part of Mission Impossible 1 is that he's not on an actual bullet train. Because you know Tom Cruise would make them do an actual bullet train in actual France, and they would actually have attached a fucking helicopter to it.
And in a tunnel.
In like, a tunnel, yes.
They would have done the entire thing practically.
Yeah. Because they do crazier shit in this new movie.
Oh, yes, definitely. Yeah.
So, anyway, but Mission Impossible 1 is good.
Yes, very good. With, like, a really good middle section with the Langley stuff, and that whole heist sequence is awesome.
Yep. It's a good movie. There's also the scene where John Voight and Tom Cruise are talking, and Tom Cruise figures out John Voight's the bad guy, but he doesn't tell John Voight. That is some of the best like spy filmmaking just like 5 minutes I've ever seen. Okay, that one's good. And Ethan Hunt in that one is just a sort of sober, normal character. Totally feels like he could become the guy in the later movies.
Yeah, but he feels a bit more like obviously he's extremely skilled, but he feels like relative to the abilities of an IMF agent, a relative rookie, right?
Yes, and he's just he's sort of like a normal guy. You could imagine them continuing the franchise without him, even it could be an anthology Mission Impossible or something. But they didn't do that. They did Mission Impossible 2. It is one of the zaniest Hollywood blockbusters I've ever seen. John Woo'd it up good.
Yep, there are lots of doves. Ethan Hunt jumps through the air and fires two pistols at the same time, which again, he never does in the later movies. He's abandoned that technique along the way.
He walks through fire with a dove on his shoulder.
Yep, there's a lot of opera music and very, very tight, slow close-up zoom-ins on people's eyes and seeing the reflection in their eye.
Yes, Dougray Scott is the villain, and it's great because Dougray Scott can't act, but he's perfect for that terrible role.
Yep, there about every single character puts on about 5 different super masks over the course of that movie.
And Ving Rhames came back. Ving Rhames, who is just, I fucking love Ving Rhames.
Yeah, I love that they brought him back for all the movies, even if four is the one where he has the tiny role at the end. Yeah,
it's four, but he's been substantial in all the other ones. Did you hear the news story about Ving Rhames this weekend?
Yes, yeah, the whole...
Fucking cops! I feel like I shouldn't get that on audio, but whatever. Fucking cops break into Ving Rhames' house and hold him at gunpoint because some racist neighbor called the cops on Ving Rhames for being in his own home. I want the next Mission Impossible movie to be about the IMF going after that police department.
Yes. Or just like the documentary made about how like Ving Rhames just called up Tom Cruise and Tom Cruise used his like incredible wealth and influence to just destroy their lives. Fucking do that to Ving Rhames, guys.
He got the Sea Org to put them all in a yacht out to sea.
Scientology's the motherfuckers.
All right. Anyway, so that's that. Okay, so first two we've talked about.
Yes.
Mission Impossible 3. I'm interested to hear this, Sean, because this is the only one you had seen.
Yes, again, I'd seen it in theaters. Like, I was with a friend, and we went to go see it in the theater.
This one is 2006.
Yes.
We might not have known each other when that movie came out.
No, I don't think we did.
Because that would have been summer before 8th grade, and we met in 8th grade.
Yeah.
Wow. So this is like, this is edge of Sean and I knowing each other.
Yes, this is...
This franchise is so old!
It way predates this podcast. Like, way predates this podcast. Because that's the third movie.
We're talking about a franchise that is ongoing and better than ever, and it started when we were 4.
Uh-huh.
It's nuts. Anyway, what did you think about it now, seeing it again?
I like it quite a bit. I think it's not as strong a movie as I remember, because, you know, I saw it when I was fucking, like, 12 or whatever, so it like, made a very big impression on me seeing it in the theaters, because I can, like, and I still don't watch a lot of these kinds of movies. It's not, like, my particular genre of action. I tend to go more for, like, the kung fu, that kind of stuff is what I like in action, but these movies do this, like, the American car chase, like, big gun battle stuff really well. And yeah, I think Mission Impossible 3, you can see some of the J.J. Abramsiness in it a little bit with like the rabbit's foot. And there's like a little, I wish like, there's a little bit of glue in the plot that doesn't feel quite there. That is very much a like, kind of how The Force Awakens feels to me. And there's like a overemphasis of slickness with like a little bit lacking in fundamentals. But even with that, I think it is an incredibly slick movie. It has some stuff also in it, though, that did feel like, I don't know, like weirdly influential. Like, there are parts of it that reminded me so much of Captain America the Winter Soldier. Like very specific sequences and shots that are like, this is like, Captain America the Winter Soldier just kind of did this scene in, like, the elevator and the highway action scene. Not to say that Mission Impossible 3 invented action scenes on highways, but there's something specific about how some of those sequences are shot.
Well, some of it also is just, I think Mission Impossible is the real deal. So, you know, when you're watching Captain America the Winter Soldier, you're kind of getting, like, the off-brand Oreo of that thing. Yeah. It still can be really good, but it's a Marvel movie. It's not going to be the best action ever shot for anything. You watch Mission Impossible, that's a real Oreo.
Yes.
And then maybe you see like one of the Japanese Yakuza movies where they're all in an elevator together, and that's like a some really good cookie that's not an Oreo, that's like actually handmade and everything, and that's the actual best thing, but you know what I mean.
Yes, So, but yeah, there's a lot of great action in Mission Impossible 3. Obviously, fucking Philip Seymour Hoffman is so unbelievably good in that movie. Like, he's only in a couple of scenes, but he owns that movie so hard.
He's the best villain this franchise will ever have.
Yeah.
Although I think Sean Harris in these last two is fucking great.
Yeah.
But Philip Seymour Hoffman, it's a special performance. It's because he doesn't give a fuck.
And he does the thing that I feel like a lot of... Because here's the other thing that made Mission Impossible 3 feel like this is, like, weirdly ahead of its time, is that it was 2006, and that was, like, you know, a couple of years pre-Dark Knight. Like, it was, like... I would have to look at a timeline and, like, look at a lot of other movies, but it feels like it is one of the earliest of the, like, supervillain that you capture, and when you capture him is when he's the most dangerous, that, like, every movie from, like, 2008 to about 2012, like, Dark Knight and Skyfall and Avengers all did that thing. Philip Seymour Hoffman is the best of all of those.
Like, easily.
Because
he... Well, Heath Ledger's Joker is...
But I would say there's something about Philip Seymour Hoffman that he does the thing of being what so many people want these villains to be, which is they're not physically intimidating. Like, you know, it's not fucking Henry Cavill from Mission Impossible Fall. You know, it doesn't look like Philip Seymour Hoffman would kick my ass. But it's just like, this dude is just so unbelievably charismatic that he can just look at you and I am fucking terrified.
Right.
Like, and he doesn't need makeup. He doesn't need it. Like, he just fucking looks at you and it's like, fucking holy shit, I don't want to be in a room with this man. Like, it makes my skin crawl watching his performance.
He's so good. And the other thing I love in terms of a plot setup thing is that he's only the main villain because the IMF fucks with him and he decides to fuck back.
Yeah.
Like, I've seen Drew McWeeny, the former critic for HitFix, solo critic now, has said this a bunch about Mission Impossible 3, and I love this reading of the movie. It's basically like every Mission Impossible episode of the TV show had some point in the hour where they, like, kidnapped someone, made a mask, and pretended to be them. And Mission Impossible 3 is that setup, but then the guy they kidnapped decided he was going to rain hell on them.
Yes.
And it's so true. It's like, because up to that point, like, he's just a guy that's kind of in their way.
Yeah, he's an arms dealer.
Right, he's not the end goal. And they do that, and then he decides, like, and after, especially after Ethan holds him out of the fucking airplane, he's like, okay, you guys asked for it.
Yeah.
And craziness happens. I think Mission Impossible 3 is great. It's behind the Chris McQuarrie ones. It's my favorite. And I think it is super well directed. Like, you know, J.J. Abrams is, if nothing else, a very slick director. And I want to see him do more of this kind of thing.
Yeah.
Where, I mean, Mission Impossible is obviously a franchise movie, but it's not Star Trek or Star Wars. It's so much more grounded. And I think he truly is a very talented, like, visual craftsman. I love the kind of colors and texture of this movie. I think it stages action surprisingly well because, like, I think Abrams' future movies have a lot of good action in them. They're not lacking by any means, but they're not this good in terms of action choreography and stuff. Like, there's that chase early on with the helicopters through the wind blades on the wind farm where they're trying to save Kerry Russell. It's outstanding. It's really outstanding. This movie has by far the most Tom Cruise running in any movie. And when Tom Cruise runs, it's good things happen.
Yes, it's exciting.
He runs a lot in Mission Impossible 3. He runs to fucking music. He runs in... Are they in Thailand at the end?
Somewhere around. I think they might be in China. I don't remember.
I don't remember, yeah. Because this one, it has some stuff in China, but it's before they made a Chinese partnership deal, which they didn't find.
Right, because that's also the other part of the movie that is like, they just did this in The Dark Knight. They just did this whole, like, Chinese skyscraper, or, like, Shanghai skyscrapers in, like, the fucking parachute. This is just that scene in The Dark Knight.
I made that joke when I was watching it with my brother. I said... Because there's even actually, the big one is, there is a shot in, I think they're in Hong Kong, right?
I think so, yeah.
I think it's supposed to be Hong Kong. I don't know if they're actually in Hong Kong, but it's supposed to be. And Tom Cruise is standing on a building, ready to make the jump, and the camera is, it's a helicopter shot that, like, starts way high before you can see Ethan, and then comes to pan in down onto him. They do that exact shot in The Dark Knight with Batman.
Yeah.
And, like, I had not maybe, and I made that joke, but I hadn't made the connection that there's more of it than just that. I wonder. I'm not saying Chris Nolan plagiarized anything. Just
no,
that
it's like people borrow things and they're just like, you know, it was a trend. Like a lot of those kinds of things were trends at that time. But
I wouldn't be surprised if he watched and liked this movie.
Yeah, exactly.
And like decided to, you know, borrow things here and there. No, that's great. I think the finale stuff where he's having to run to save Julia and then he has the thing that goes off in his head and Julia's having to like, he has to like electrocute himself with the wires. And all I'm thinking is, what is the chance that Tom Cruise, like, asked to do that with actual electrical wires? And, like, they, JJ had to, like, talk him down and be like, we can't get insurance for this, Tom.
It's like, no, you just stop my heart, and then you can start it again with another shock. It'll work great. It'll be a great shot.
Tom,
great shot.
Michelle Monaghan is not an actual nurse, or doctor, or whatever she is.
It's like, then we just get a stunt nurse in here. Like, yeah. we can do this shot. It'll be, we really need to convince people. It's like, Tom, people have pretending to be dead for literally 2,000 plus years on stage. It's fine. You can just pretend. It's like, no, we need to, I think these movies, mission is all about authenticity, JJ.
Yes. I don't know. But anyway, that's great. I love that he has to do the last fight with Philip Seymour Hoffman now. Because that's a great way to make it, like, Hoffman, his character would never stand up to Ethan Hunt under normal circumstances.
Yeah.
But he's got a fucking fuse going off in his brain. They can duke it out, and then Hoffman gets hit by a fucking car, and it's great.
That's a very good shot of when they roll, and he flips him over, and it's like, oh, just like this good look up into the camera and get hit by the truck.
Yeah. It's good. I do think, I love Michelle Monaghan. She is just, in the mid-2000s, she almost became a big thing, like between this and Kiss Kiss Bang Bang and that shitty Shia LaBeouf movie she was in, but she's good in it. And she didn't, like, she's not a huge star, and it makes me sad because I really like Michelle Monaghan. I think her character is underwritten in 3.
Yeah.
But
she very much is, like, the wife character. Yeah.
But I also do appreciate, like, especially after the weird whiplash of 1 and 2, to just try to humanize Ethan Hunt and, like, give him something. Because that's the thing. It's like, this movie has a personal stakes that do feel genuine. Like, I think there's that really nice little scene where they get married in, like, the hospital chapel.
Yeah.
Where it's just like, that's good. Like, this is a fundamental thing to, like, get in there. And I think, if nothing else, like, even if you don't like Mission Impossible 3, you don't get the future ones without this one. Like, this is what made it, I think, a viable franchise. It's the third movie. It's kind of a weird thing to say. But, like, you couldn't do the John Woo thing again.
Yeah, but yeah, because 1 and 2 are so different. And 3 definitely sort of set it right. There are a couple other things with Mission Impossible 3. One that I just thought, like, this goes back a while to, like, when I originally watched it, of, like, how much I misunderstood what Mission Impossible was, is I had for so long, before I kind of heard what the first two movies were, I thought for sure those first two movies were, like the Michelle Monaghan character and Tom Cruise were, like, in a relationship and, like, building up to the beginning of Mission Impossible 3 where they're finally getting married. I thought for sure that, like, Mission Impossible 2 ended with him getting engaged to her.
So that's awesome.
The beginning of this movie so feels like that. And, again, I hadn't watched a lot of these kinds of things like Indiana Jones or James Bond where it's just all the movies are like, it's just kind of its own thing. Maybe there's a reference. Or, like, Uncharted is that way of, like, Chloe just sort of shows up at the beginning of Uncharted 2, and they refer to, oh, we've had all this, like, past relationship, and you could be forgiven for thinking, oh, they must have met in Uncharted 1, and that was how the story started. And that's exactly what I thought Mission Impossible 3 was until, like, probably when I was, like, 18 or something, and then ended up reading a Wikipedia thing, and was like, oh, that's not what these movies are at all. I had no idea.
Yeah. No, that's an interesting perspective, because I had seen 1 and 2 when I saw 3 back in the day. When I was a kid, I found 1 too boring to enjoy.
I can see that.
It's not a kid's movie.
Yeah, no. Yeah, it's definitely not.
Now I love it, but yes. Okay, anything else to say about Mission Impossible 3? Do you want to talk about the scene that feels like a Hitman scene
to you? Yes, I want to just talk about how it is a Hitman movie. Or at least, like, not the whole movie. The middle part of the movie is just Hitman. If you did a couple of things different, like throw some fire extinguishers into people's heads and maybe jab a screwdriver in someone's neck, it would just be Hitman. The whole Vatican sequence of that, all they're trying to do is get the identity of Philip Seymour Hoffman. Obviously, they use super masks because they're nowhere near, like, IMF is good. They're not Agent 47 good. They can't just put on a fucking hat and some glasses that this dude had. And everyone's just like, oh, hey, Philip Seymour Hoffman, just come right here. Wow. It's like, yes, I'm wearing the same suit as him. I know I don't have the hair or anything else, but it's definitely me, Philip Seymour Hoffman. So they're not quite that good, so they need the weird masks. But all they're trying to do is get him in the fucking bathroom so they can knock him out and assume his identity, which is step one of what you do in every single Hitman level. As soon as you load up Hitman, I'm going to try to find some way to get this person in the bathroom, and I'm going to knock them out, and then I'm going to take their clothes and assume their identity.
I think I said to Thomas while we were watching this, good God, I want a Hitman level at the Vatican.
Yes, yeah. Because that's the other thing, is it is true of a lot of the locations, particularly from 3 onwards, is you get a lot of, like, the very sort of exquisite, exotic, like, big, you know, environments with, like, all the, like, art and ornamentation that feels like some of those richer Hitman levels, like the Paris level or the Bangkok level or Hokkaido and stuff. It's just like, I'm in a super rich location that's kind of exotic from an American perspective with a bunch of rich people that I need to knock out and take their face and then kill people, someone with it.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's, yeah, that Vatican section is so slickly made and well edited, and just the whole way it's put together is really good.
It's, yeah.
Yeah. I also, this is where you start to get female supporting team members who I kept wishing they would bring back and never did until Rebecca Ferguson in 5 and 6. In this one, it is, is it Maggie Q?
Yes, Maggie Q. Yeah.
She's awesome. I mean, Maggie Q should just be in more things because she's cool. And she's really good in this one, and they didn't bring her back. And then the same thing happens with Paula Patton in the next one. But then we got Rebecca Ferguson in All Is Right with the World.
Yes. Also, 3 is where Simon Pegg enters the franchise as, like, a very minor role. Like, kind of almost blink and you miss him. He's, like, in 2 scenes.
He's in exactly 2 scenes.
Yeah.
But they're very good. Because he has the scene at the end where crazy Ethan Hunt is on the phone with him. And you just, if you're in Simon Pegg's shoes, it sounds ludicrous.
Yes. Yeah.
So, that's great.
I just love that Simon Pegg ends up becoming like a staple character of this franchise from that appearance.
If you have access to Simon Pegg, use Simon Pegg.
Yes.
It's a very easy principle. Also, this one and 4 have scores by Michael Giacchino, and they're great.
Yeah.
Like, I actually think the scores for, other than 2, which is a really weird Hans Zimmer score where Hans Zimmer was drunk or something, I'm kidding, but it sounds very bizarre. I like the scores for all these movies. Danny Elfman did 1, and it's great. I think Giacchino's score for 3 is fantastic. It was actually kind of interesting for me because I think I respect Michael Giacchino a lot. I think his 2000s work was substantially more interesting than his 2010s work, where I think he's overextended himself and become kind of a predictable, homogenized composer.
You got there.
But like Mission Impossible 3 totally sounds like an action movie version of his Lost score. And it's really good. It's beautiful. I think Ghost Protocol is the same way. He's just very good at this, and I wanted to note that. Like, he has a love theme for, like, Michelle Monaghan and Tom Cruise. It's like, the romance in no way, like, earns this, but it's really good. It's, like, very good music.
Yes. Yeah.
Kind of a, we'll call it a Star Wars Episode 2 effect.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, the music sells it more than anything else. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. So now we're back to movies you had not seen.
Yes.
This is Brad Bird's movie.
I think this one, other than Fallout, overtakes it for me. But before Fallout, this one's actually my favorite.
Interesting. This one is interesting because I actually think I like this one less than most people.
Huh.
I think 2/3 of this is a great action movie. And then I think the last 1/3 is convoluted mediocrity, but like fun. Like I shouldn't even say mediocrity. I think it's well above average. I just think this one suffers more than any of the Mission Impossible movies for me from the second act is so good, they run out of steam, and then they have to, like, kind of limp their way to the finish line.
I can see that. That's also kind of how I feel about 5, though. Like, I think 4 and 5 are actually very similar movies.
I don't want to hear any bad words about my beloved 5.
Okay.
It's okay. No. Here's the thing. Ghost Protocol has the section in Dubai, which is, like, 30 or 40 minutes of interlocking set pieces, where you have Tom Cruise on the Burj Khalifa climbing that thing, you have Tom Cruise and everybody inside having to deal with the different, like, spy hijinks.
Yeah, because they're getting one person in one room and one person in the other room and assuming opposite identities to assume opposite identities of who they're trying to meet to basically be on both sides of a, like, trade deal.
Yes. So you have all of that. Then when the thing goes south, you have a big fight sequence, and then Tom Cruise has to literally outrun a sandstorm in Dubai, which is awesome. And, like, that whole interlocking, like, 30, 40 minutes is fucking phenomenal. One of the best things in this franchise. And then I think the movie gets fairly dull for me from there on. But I do like it a lot. I also don't like the villain in this movie. I think the plot gets a little convoluted at points, but it is very good.
Yes. But it also has, like, the opening sequence where they're invading Russia and all that stuff is also
fucking awesome. Yeah.
The screen. That might be my favorite bit of, like, spy technology in any of these kinds of movies is the big screen they have that projects the video onto it, and they, like, have to slowly move it forward.
That's when they're in the Kremlin.
Yeah, they're in the Kremlin. Yeah, and that's when Simon Pegg, Benji, gets to be he's somehow a field agent. I still don't entirely believe that Benji went through the training and is, like, authorized to be, like, he's not Ethan Hunt from Mission Impossible 1. Like, I don't know if he's authorized to be in the field here.
I like the beginning where he's in prison and the whole prison break thing.
Yeah.
Especially, like, Brad Bird scores it to, like, some piece of 50s music or something. Yeah. And it's so good. It's just very well choreographed.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love all of that stuff.
Yeah. But, like, it's definitely the action in Ghost Protocol definitely, like, vastly overshadows the other qualities of the movie where, like, I don't even really remember what the plot of it was. It's nuclear probably something. Like, IMF something.
Yeah, it gets convoluted. Because here's the thing. I should also say, like, you've seen each of these once. Yes. Except Mission Impossible 3. I've seen Ghost Protocol like 4 or 5 times, so okay. It's just settled for me more, you know, because I saw it in theaters, I've seen it on Blu-ray, and I was definitely over the moon about it the first time I saw it, and then it was like the second time I'm like, okay, this part's a little creaky. You don't get to the Ghost Protocol thing until like 50 minutes into the movie, which is sort of a weird length for your first act. The second act is fantastic, but then like, this is definitely a movie where the three acts are really subjugated from one another. Yeah. And then, like, the third act, they have to go and do something again. And there's the whole thing with Paula Patton and the dude from Slumdog Millionaire that goes on forever and is kind of weird and gross.
Oh, right. Yeah.
That's yeah. Right. Yeah. That's in there. I do like the final scene where Tom Cruise is fighting the bad guy in the, like, parking garage.
Parking garage that's spinning around and cars
and
falling everywhere.
The movie does of just the briefcase is at the bottom of this parking garage. I'm at the top of this parking garage, so I'm just going to get in a car and drive it off the side of it. That is wonderful.
Yeah.
And I love that he goes, mission accomplished, and like hits the button, but it doesn't work. That's fantastic. I also think the ending is a weird cop-out, where like the whole movie is about how Ethan is in a weird dark place, but then there's this, and they don't even really fully tell us what happened there until Mission Impossible Fallout with him and his wife.
Yeah.
And that scene always didn't sit quite right with me, but I don't know.
But that fucking Dubai sequence, dude, is,
oh my God, let's talk about that.
So unbelievably good. Especially the part once he has to, because he has to climb up there, once he gets there, and just everything of them climbing up and the gloves not working and all that shit is so good. But then once he gets up there, he's like, well, now I have to find a way to get back down. And he just fucking breaks the window, grabs a hose, and jumps out and like swings on this hose, has to do like this big swinging jump to get in there. Like, that, other than, again, once you get to Fallout, I think the ending sequence of Fallout tops it for me. But that whole section, to me, was the most impressive action sequence. And, like, when he jumps off the thing and then bucks his head, it doesn't, like, quite clear it into the window. Like, I, like, literally went like, whoa!
Yes.
It's just like, oh my God.
Now, Sean, you saw that on your 40-inch TV.
Yeah.
That scene was shot in IMAX 65mm.
Jesus.
And that's how I do. It was digital, but it was still the full IMAX at our Colorado Center IMAX. Imagine seeing that 8 stories high on a screen, and it's that big. It's floor to ceiling of him on the Burj Khalifa. It was one of the most out-of-body things I've ever seen in a movie theater.
Yeah, it's unreal.
It's unreal. It's also, Ghost Protocol is one of the best-looking Blu-rays you can own. Because I think partially of those IMAX sequences, but it looks so good. All that Dubai stuff. The Mission Impossible movies, more than any other long-running action franchise to me, understand the number one rule for making a great action sequence is whenever you think you've pushed it enough, you need to push it 3 more steps.
Yeah.
So, like, if you think it's enough that Tom Cruise has to, like, climb up the side of the Burj Dubai, like, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Right? But no, let's also have one of his gloves not work. Let's have, once he's up there, he doesn't know how to get back down. And once he gets back down, let's have it not be a clean landing.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, they always, and Fallout does this a lot, but they all do this of, like, as soon as you think you've pushed it to the line, you have to go 3 steps past that line.
Yeah.
And they do it so well in these movies.
Yes.
Yep. So, okay, that's Ghost Protocol. It's good. People love this one. The stuff I love about this one, I love intensely. You could cut out the Dubai sequence, and it's just a great short film.
Yeah.
Like, you don't even really need the context. It's just great. So I like that one. I wish it had more Ving Rhames, but that's okay.
Yes.
Oh, that's the other thing I don't like about that one, is I think Jeremy Renner is boring and weird in that one.
One thing I do love about it, though, is at the beginning of the movie, he is set up as, like, I'm this analyst character. And I'm like, oh my God, did Jeremy Renner get to be in a movie where he's not playing... And I'm not blaming Jeremy Renner for this. This is not Jeremy Renner's fault.
Right.
But he plays the same character because he's written for the same character in every fucking movie, which is, like, sarcastic, world-weary, super-effective military dude. That's who he is as Hawkeye. That's who he is as in The Hurt Locker, which is, like, his breakout role. It was, like, what was the other one I saw? Oh, yeah, 28 Weeks Later, when I ended up rewatching that for, I think there's some class that I was talking about zombie stuff. I wanted to rewatch that movie.
The shitty Bourne movie he did, is that?
Yes, yeah. I haven't even seen that one, and I already knew. This, like, every fucking role Jeremy Renner ever played place is that exact same character. At the beginning of Ghost Protocol, he's set up as being like, I mean, he's technically sort of like in an arm of the military, but he's a data analyst dude. And then, of course, halfway through the movie, you get the twist of like, no, he's actually like an ex-agent who was like, got himself delisted or whatever because he failed at a mission. And then after that, in the final action sequence, he is then now, having been revealed to be an agent dude, playing Hawkeye and like all those characters because he is now written as that character. It's just like, there's sort of a meta component to Jeremy Renner's role in that movie that I kind of adore.
Yes, it's funny. He's used much better, I think, in Rogue Nation.
Yes, I agree with that.
Yeah. So let's talk about Rogue Nation.
Okay, yes.
Which is a movie Fallout's even better. I am, like, sexually in love with this movie.
Okay.
I'm just going to put it out there.
Okay.
I was when it came out. There's so much good about it. That fucking scene at the opera where Tom Cruise and Rebecca Ferguson are there, and Tom Cruise is trying to figure out what's going out at this on at this opera scene, and Simon Pegg is helping him, and he realizes, and someone's brought in a gun and a flute, and he is like, there's this plot, and then he sees that Ilsa Faust is there, and he doesn't really know what's going on. Like, and it's like a good 15 minutes, mostly without any dialogue, just with like actual opera playing over the movie. It is so well shot, it is so well edited, and it is a set piece, but not an action sequence. It is an espionage scene that is just slow and cerebral and visual, and you just never see things like that, and it's so good. I love that so much.
Yeah, it's really good. I don't know if I'm like quite as so in love with it as you are, but it's
very good. There's the fucking car chase in the middle of that one, where first they're doing all the stuff in the city, and he goes off the like edge of the cliff, and like it's this crazy car crash, and then he just gets right back up, and with that, but that's after he's in the underwater part, and he's like died and come back and does the car chase. Then he gets on the motorcycle to chase Ilsa Faust, and they're going really fast. And Ilsa Faust is just the best fucking character. And Ving Rhames is in this one more.
He is.
And it's really good. And Sean Harris has a crazy, creepy villain voice. And then at the end, they catch him in the box and they go, "Welcome to the IMF." And I'm like, fuck yeah. I really love Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. I could watch this movie every day of the week.
I think I love it a lot. The one thing I don't like about it is I think the dialogue is really weak. Like, the dialogue is so cliche-ridden, it kind of kicked me out of the movie in scenes of like, every scene is a spy movie cliche piece of dialogue. Like, it's, and they do this a little bit in Fallout, but it's just a lot of like, "and you would be doing exactly what he wants you to do," which is like, I can't hear that kind of dialogue anymore.
I don't listen to the dialogue anymore.
It would have been better if it was like a silent movie, honestly, for me, of like, I think it's so spectacularly directed and edited, and the performances themselves are good, but like, the actual like, line by line stuff is so rote action movie stuff that like it's I just don't have a super high tolerance for that. I think it's one of the reasons why I don't have as great a love for this genre as you do, is because like those cliche lines just like bug me in a way.
Mission Impossible 3 does have the part where Tom Cruise gets on top of the Vatican wall and turns to the camera and goes, "Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall."
I said, I like this one more than Mission Impossible 3. My like rankings for these would be like 2, 1, and 3,
Sean,
or maybe...
We're going to do rankings
okay,
later.
Okay,
save rankings.
Okay, but yeah.
You thought I was going to let you get out of here without ranking.
I'm just saying this, like, I don't think Mission Impossible 3 is the greatest one either.
Okay, that's fine. I was just going to say, like, so I guess I'm a little inoculated to the bad dialogue.
Yeah.
It's like, I feel like they reached a peak with the Humpty Dumpty line. But yes, no, I get what you mean. It's...
I also think that, like, I do like the, like, trapping the Sean Harris villain in the glass thing at the end, and they call back to the beginning, but I feel like it was slightly anticlimactic. There's not a... Like, I like, you know, I want something huge, like, you know, fucking... Yeah, like, you know, you're obviously not going to do a John Woo, like, top of John Woo, fucking, like, kick the gun up in the air and grab it, like, do this whole thing. But, you know, having Philip Seymour Hoffman get hit by a car, or the best one is what happens to Henry Cavill at the end of, like,
yes.
The Fallout is really good. Just, like, that's how you get rid of a villain in one of these movies.
Yes. I do think, like, what works for me about Rogue Nation, because here's a weird thing, is Rogue Nation, I loved very much when it came out in theaters. I talked about it on this podcast. But I did think, like, the third act was maybe the weakest part. When I rewatched it, I didn't think that. Like, I actually think this movie has a much smoother, like, act-to-act movement than the 3 or 4 up to this point. Where, like, 4 especially is very subdivided, where, like, it's 3 movies put together with, like, a loosely following goal between them. And then the third act kind of is a letdown after the Dubai stuff. What I like is that Rogue Nation kind of reaches its peak with the underwater, you know, car chase, motorcycle chase, like, threefer in the middle. And then they don't try to top it. Like, they don't even attempt to top that. What they do at the end is they really stay calm, they stay quiet, and it's like there's that whole scene where Sean Harris's character is talking through Simon Pegg at the table, and Ilsa Faust is there. And so it's like it's much more like this kind of cat and mouse game that's going on. I really like all of that. And it just, like, because the movie starts and ends with he's trying to get to Sean Harris, there is a much cleaner, I think, like, through line on this one than in a lot of them.
I agree with that. I think maybe part of my issue with that stuff is it doesn't ring totally true of the Ethan Hunt character to me. That's like, I just feel like Ethan Hunt's not necessarily the cat and mouse, like, I'm going to super outsmart you and manipulate all this stuff in this way. Like, I don't feel like that... while I appreciate that dynamic, and I think, like, in terms of the, like, scene-by-scene execution, I think the cat and mouse stuff is done really well. I think, like, the bigger storytelling, like, picture of setting up the villain and setting up the hero as playing that game, I think there are, like, some weird pieces missing that don't totally, like, invest me in the idea that they're having that kind of, like, mental chess battle, you know, that they're trying to set you up as believing.
Ethan Hunt also does the thing in this movie where he, like, reads the disc of all the, like, money stuff that Sean Harris wants, and he memorizes it and then has them, and then fucking destroys it because he'll never let it get into the guy's hands, and he says, I'll show you, sign good faith, and he writes the thing on the thing, it's like $40 million right here. It's just, this movie is like, it's got so many moments that just like hit me in my pleasure centers of the brain. Of sure. Like, that is so cool. There's that. We have to talk about Ilsa Faust. Rebecca Ferguson,
oh, yeah.
She's so awesome.
Amazing. Yeah.
She's amazing. I love that character. Like, there's some cliched things there, definitely, but I do genuinely love, like, this is one character type they had not done up to that point, which is, like, female spy who is just as good as Ethan is, but kind of, but she's not quite his ally, not quite his enemy.
Yeah.
And so, like, when they go up against each other, they have a really interesting chemistry. Like, and I actually think Tom Cruise is an interesting actor in a lot of ways. One of them is that, like, he does not have chemistry with other actors the way a lot of actors have chemistry.
Yeah.
You know? Like, I don't know if I've ever really bought Tom Cruise in a romance in, like, one of his modern movies. Maybe if you go back to, like, the 80s or 90s or something. But, like, but I do think you can have interesting, like, professional relationships for Ethan Hunt. You know, like, he has that very easy friendship with Ving Rhames and his relationship with Simon Pegg. But, like, when he and Rebecca Ferguson are on screen, it's not like sexual sparks fly, but sparks are flying.
Yeah.
It's just very exciting. I love that there's a lot of double crosses. Like, the more double crosses, the better with this kind of thing. Which, Fallout, whoo, boy.
Yeah.
Wow, chef's kiss on the double crosses front. But, like, I just think she's a great character. And it's awesome. That's all.
I do think it's got, well, I think McHugh makes the best use of the mask reveals. And that's, like, true in 5, and then I think there's an even better one in 6. Even when, like, you know, particularly in 5, I think it'd be hard not to realize the mask twist in Act 3 of, like, who's under the mask and all that shit. But it is just, like, the stakes in, like, the scene is set up in such a way to make the mask reveal, like, incredibly well done, in a way that I feel like the other movies, other than 2 has great mask shit.
Yes.
2 has, I take it back, 2 has the best mask stuff, has the best mask scene with the villain in the fucking, the Hitchman with the Tom Cruise mask. But other than that, like, I feel like 5 and 6 weirdly make the best use of the mask, even though,
well,
each successive movie, I keep on wondering, when are they not going to do the masks anymore, because it is the by far the most unbelievable part of all these movies, these fucking masks.
But, like, you have to do it.
Yeah.
Because the thing is, in all the other movies, though, it's usually, like, they're putting on the mask, and we know what they're doing it for.
Yeah.
In 5 and 6, they don't ever do the scene where, like, someone gets ready with the mask. It's, we're going to make it a reveal later on. And that's just a more fun way to do it.
Yeah.
Because I agree, like, this is the other thing McHugh is calling him. McQuarrie does, I think, really well in 5 and 6, is make the mission seem genuinely impossible.
Uh-huh.
Like, there's a point where Tom Cruise, at the end of Rogue Nation, like, or near the, like, third act of Rogue Nation, like, Ilsa Faust has gotten away. He doesn't have any of the information. They've stolen Simon Pegg. And now he's supposed to, like, get the drive, and to authenticate it, he has to kidnap the Prime Minister. And Ving Rhames is like, Ethan, we can't do this! And Ethan's like, and you can just, I love how Tom Cruise plays these moments where Ethan is, like, faced with something truly impossible and just has to force through and decide, we're gonna figure it out. We're gonna figure it out.
I'll do this.
And
yeah,
it's like, okay.
You can do it.
Because that is what makes Ethan Hunt Ethan Hunt, is that he genuinely never sees a scenario and says, I can't do this. He says, okay, the thing is getting away in a helicopter. I'm not in this helicopter, but I could get on that rope to that helicopter, and I'll figure it out from there.
Yeah.
Like, that is who he is. Is no matter what the fucking stakes, he'll say, we can figure it out. We can figure it out.
One of the other things I do really like about Rogue Nation also is, like, kind of the setup for the movie with, like, the Alec Baldwin character and all that stuff with the CIA is finally the movie's acknowledging that the IMF is, like, the most dysfunctional fucking government agency in, like, the continuity of these movies. Especially because 1, 2, and 3 in particular all are about some, like, IMF person has double-crossed the agency. And one, it's John Voight, and two, it's the weird villain dude who's like...
Dude, Scott.
Yeah, who was fucking Ethan Hunt's second, who's like, oh, if Ethan Hunt's busy on a mission, and we just have this dude dress up like Ethan Hunt and do it. Which, like, I could see if you're getting, like, the super mega hard, like, mega spy guy, and it's like, oh, you're just, like... Fucking playing second fiddle to this dude and have to put on his mask to be him. I could see why he would go turn villain. And then in three, it's a whole weird sequence with like Lawrence Fishburne and then the other dude. And it's like, oh, actually, it's the other dude, not the Lawrence Fishburne man. But,
yes, one, two, and three, the primary villain is a mole inside IMF.
Yeah. And so they just do that plot so many times. And then, yeah. And so it's just, it's a
person. And then four, they ghost protocoled everyone.
Yeah. So, yeah. And four, the secretary gets killed and they're all disavowed and like the IMF is disbanded. And then also, like, is four the one where Tom Cruise just gives them the nuclear weapons? Like,
yes.
Like, I guess he kind of does in Fallout also, but like he literally doesn't go vertical. He just specifically hands them the nuclear codes. Right, that's in the Dubai scene. Instead of being like, well, I guess we can't make the fake ones because our thing broke. So we'll just give them the actual nuclear codes. And at that point, it's like, no, legitimately, the IMF should be disbanded. Like, legitimately. Because he's like, oh, because it's the whole scene where Tom Cruise is just like, if we let him get away, we will never have another opportunity to do this. Like, what do you mean? Like, of course you'll have another opportunity. Like, you'll just find another, like, you'll figure this shit out. Like, don't give him the goddamn nuclear codes. Yeah, so it's like, yeah, in each progressive movie, it's just constantly like, yep, you're in the first one, it's an agent that double-crossed you. In the second one, it's an agent that fully joined another organization. And in three, it's like the fucking, like, one of the directors of the organization has betrayed you. In four, the whole organization is dismantled, and then the key agent gives the villain the nuclear weapons. And so by the time you get to five, Alec Baldwin's just like, you guys can't do this shit. Like, this is not, like, it's got the, one of the best moments of the whole movie is when Alec Baldwin's doing the whole presentation. He says, here's the Kremlin before the IMF showed up. Here's the Kremlin after the IMF showed up and it's all destroyed. And it's like, usually I think these characters can be annoying in these movies. I 100% agree with the Alec Baldwin character. The IMF should not exist. They have only fucked up time and time and time again.
But that's what's so fun.
Yeah, it's great.
Also, I think the only movie, and this is true also now that we have six, where beginning to end, Ethan Hunt is sanctioned by the U.S. government to do what he was doing, weirdly, is Mission Impossible 2.
Yes.
That is the only one.
Mission Impossible 2 is him performing the most normal mission in any of these movies.
It is. It's so weird. But like in one, he's on the run because he's been framed. In three, he's on the run because he's been framed. In four, he's on the run because the whole thing got disavowed. In five, he's on the run because they shut the whole organization out again. And in six, most of the movie, he's on the right side of the law, but for a little bit, they think he's...
Yeah, like, I mean, the whole situation at six, I don't even know if who can and cannot be avowed based on who's in charge.
Yeah. Okay. Mission Impossible Fallout. Spoilers from here on out for the sixth Mission Impossible movie. If you have not seen it, go see it for the love of God. It's so good.
It's so fucking good.
Fallout. This is the best one, right?
Yes, definitely. Yes, definitely.
Okay, so if I had an intense sexual love for Rogue Nation, I don't know what it is for Fallout. It's like, it goes beyond that. It's existential.
It's like true platonic love. Like, not in like a platonic relationship, but I mean like in the classical proper Plato sense.
Yes.
This is your platonic ideal of a Mission Impossible movie so far.
Pretty much. I mean, it's so good. It's basically a 2.5 hour long chase sequence who they're chasing and why they're chasing them is constantly changing and crisscrossing.
Yes, and like you intimated earlier, the more double crosses, the better, and there are a lot of double crosses in this movie.
Oh, man. And to be fair, the more double crosses, the better thing is not always true. In fact, most of the time it's not. But when you do it well, it can be really fun.
Yes.
Yes. I don't even know where to start with this one. It's like every element of this one is amazing. The cinematography, the music, the action choreography, the acting across the board this is the best cast of characters they've ever had. Just the general plotting is really good and like simple, but you know, not simple, I guess I would say. There's a lot of complex stuff going on, but I think the through line is always very clear.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like, you know, we're jumping to a different movie at any point, or like the act breaks are really hard and feel like you're being taken out of things. And just on a like directorial level, how this thing is realized, it is hallucinatory at times, like how crazy some of the action in this movie is. This is a movie where the first significant action sequence is Tom Cruise doing a halo jump with Henry Cavill, landing in Paris, and then having an insane bathroom fight that feels like it's out of a 90s Hong Kong movie.
Yeah.
And it literally only gets better from there.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I appreciate about it so much is that it's not just that there's, like, a lot of action, but there's a tremendous variety to the action that I love. That, like, that bathroom scene is very different from every other action scene in the movie, you know? Like, it both in how it's shot and also just the nature of... There are a couple of other smaller fistfight scenes, the biggest one between Ilsa and the villain at the end. And there's a little bit of, like, Tom Cruise and Henry Cavill, but, like, that's not really a fist fight scene.
That's a helicopter fight scene.
Yeah, that's a helicopter fight scene that there's a little bit of a fist fight on a rocky cliff before he gets killed. But, yeah, but, like, that proper, like, hand-to-hand combat scene, like you said, kind of have, like, clear Hong Kong influences. That's where you get the great shot that's in the trailers of Henry Cavill just, like, reloading and cocking his biceps or whatever, boxing. I don't know what he's doing.
What he's doing is actually undoing his cuffs.
Sure. He's literally reloading his biceps, though, is what he's doing. It's like, okay, I, like, spent these up. Bop, bop. Okay, here we can go. I cocked him up. But yeah, and just like that, like sort of 2-on-1 fight with Tom Cruise and Henry Cavill, versus that other dude who's just kicking their fucking ass, which is great. And that's another thing is, like, I think there's a good, almost diehardish quality to Ethan Hunt gets his ass kicked for most of this movie, which is true of some of the other ones, but I feel like there are significant stretches of the other movies where it feels like Ethan Hunt's kind of on top of this and then the rug gets pulled out from under him. For almost this entire movie, it feels like, no, Ethan Hunt's, like, back to two corner for, like, this whole fucking thing.
And that's what makes it, like, this movie is taut and tense as just a wire. Like, it is, because you're right, like, Ghost Protocol is a good example of this, where Ethan Hunt feels mostly on top of things, and then at the end he has to drive the car off and breaks all his limbs, you know? But, like, mostly he's okay, whereas in this one it really is, like, he fails kind of every step of the way on this one until the last goddamn second when he's trying to get that detonator. Yeah. And not for lack of trying, though, because some crazy shit goes down in this movie. But, like, yeah, I actually think this one and Rogue Nation both do some of this, where you'll have a long action sequence where at the end Hunt does not get what he was trying to get.
Yeah.
More action movies need to be willing to do that. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like there's, like, an unwritten rule in a lot of action movies, particularly bigger American ones, where it's like, set pieces are so self-contained because you feel like you'll lose the audience if there's not a victory for the hero at the end of it. And so you have to have a big action sequence and then a rousing conclusion and then find another reason for things to keep going after that. The Mission Impossible movies shy away from that
more. Yeah.
And I like that. But yes, it's, like I said, almost hallucinatory, some of what you see in this movie.
Yeah.
I think I realized how crazy they were going with it when, like, I had heard about the halo jump thing at the beginning of the movie because they'd been talking about it, that they actually did it. Tom Cruise actually did it. They had to shoot it, like, 100 times or something. Yeah. And I'm watching, and what it didn't sink in, though, until I'm watching it, and I'm realizing, oh, they're not cutting. They're not cutting. Tom Cruise, like, there has to be some kind of augmentation on this thing. Because I don't think they actually sent them through a thunderstorm.
Yeah, like, the thunderstorm is obviously not real. Like, that's, they, like, digitally added that in, but everything else... But,
like, the camera is going down to Earth.
Yeah.
On, and we're not cutting until they're in fucking Paris.
Yeah.
That
and,
is nuts.
Yeah, and, like, when Tom Cruise is, like, swooping down to, like, grab onto Henry Cavill, like, he's actually swooping down, you know? Yep. Like, yeah, it's not faked, it's not a stunt dude, so you can get... And it's that thing of where, like... I think sometimes I can see the sentiment of people being like, well, why is it that important for the actor to be doing the stunt stuff when you have stunt doubles? It's like, obviously, like, most actors should use stunt doubles. But if you're like Tom Cruise or Jackie Chan or whatever, like, you are a stunt actor. Like, you are a stuntman. Like, you're trained to do that shit. And it does add a lot because you are able to use shots that you would not otherwise be able to use and be able to do the kind of thing you're talking about. Like, there are no cuts. Like, you can just fall this long and you can get close up in on the face and you don't have to do weird, like, digital face, like, removal stuff to fix it up and post or something. Like, you can just do these shots.
Yep. And there's a lot of that. I mean, it's why, like, the Tom Cruise running thing is such a persistent, like, part of his movies and why people enjoy it is because he's actually the guy doing the free running.
Yeah.
Like, most... people, you'd and I'm not. This isn't to put down stunt people. Stunt people are fucking awesome.
No, yeah. They're again, most actors should use stunt people because, like, you're trained to act. You're not trained to jump off rooftops. Tom Cruise is trained to jump off rooftops.
There should also be an Oscar for stunt teams. And
oh yes,
instituted this year. Yeah. And Fallout should get the inaugural one. That Oscar should have been there for like 60 years now. It hasn't been. It's stupid, but there should be one anyway. But yes, I just, my favorite detail, I was reading some about that, the Halo jump scene. Not only did they have to have, you know, Tom Cruise and some stunt actors go out the fucking airplane, that the cameraman had to do it, obviously.
Yes, yeah.
And the focus puller had to come out, too. So they have a fucking focus puller who's doing his job while jumping out of an airplane. These people are crazy.
This is like, I didn't go to film school for this. They didn't fucking, I didn't do fucking Halo Jump 101. You know? It's like, that wasn't a course they offered.
Maybe I'll see if I can get that instituted at the University of Iowa.
Yeah.
Get Halo Jump 101.
Yeah. Fucking stunt film shooting.
Yes. Man, I mean, this is what I tweeted right after I got out of the movie was, Mission Impossible Fallout is a movie made by the most talented, crazy people on Earth.
Yeah.
Because that's what it feels like. Like, it is insanity, some of what they do in this movie, but the level of, like, talent in the execution is also off the charts.
Yeah. It's to the point where I legitimately wish that they did the old Jackie Chan movie thing of having over the credits just, like, shots of how they did the stunts and, like, this is the one where fucking Jackie Chan just got, like, smacked in the head with a metal rod because, like, the thing was slightly miscalibrated or whatever. And just, like, show how all that shit is made because it is those, like, it adds your appreciation of when, at the end of, like, Police Story, you watch, like, how they set up Jackie Chan sliding down that, like, that famous shot of him sliding down the pole and all the Christmas lights exploding as he goes. It's like, here's how we set it up and here's him actually doing it. And here's, like, everybody on the crew sitting here and watching me and, like, this might be the day we don't have a job anymore because Jackie Chan is fucking dead, right? It's like, I want some of that in these movies because that's how, like, immaculate the craftsmanship is in the stunt work.
I want the shot where Tom Cruise breaks his ankle because he did that on this movie.
Yes, he did that on the movie, yeah.
And I knew, I had not known going in, but, like, I looked it up and I'm like, I bet it was the London stuff. Mm-hmm. It's the London stuff.
Well, because you can tell the shot where after it happens because they keep the shot of him because it's when he jumps from one rooftop to the other and, like, grasps onto the edge and pulls himself up and runs away and he's hobbling. He's hobbling because he broke his fucking ankle in that shot.
Jesus.
Like, they use that shot of, like, he didn't break it because, I mean, it was planned of him not quite reaching the rooftop. Obviously, what wasn't planned was him landing with his foot on the side of the rooftop in such a way that it broke. But so he does that, pulls himself up, and starts running away, and they just use that sequence. And he's like, he did break his ankle, be like, stop, shits, cut. Fucking cut, dudes. This is fucked up. Cut. I mean, obviously, after that, they're like, okay, we need to take a break from shooting because you cannot make these movies with a broken ankle, Tom Cruise.
But I love, so they broke for 9 weeks. Tom Cruise came back in 7.
Yeah.
It cost $80 million to be down for that many weeks, and the insurance company had to pay it out. I want to know how the fuck Tom Cruise is insurable at this point. But who knows? Yeah.
He probably owns the insurance company.
Maybe. But yes, it's... Yeah, so, like, there are literal injuries in this movie also. Yeah. Not the first time I think he's broken a limb on these films, but...
Probably not.
But yes.
He does some dangerous shit in these movies, if you didn't notice.
He's 56 in this.
God, every time I think about that. Did you see the Twitter thing that said that pointed out he's 2 years younger than John Voight was in Mission Impossible 1? That's just like, what the fuck, dude?
Hey, you know, whatever that Scientology shit is, it's working for him.
Yeah.
His Thetan levels are real good. I don't know which direction the theme levels need to be. I don't know if it's going to be up or down.
But they're good, whatever.
They're good. All right. Anyway, we're going to be all over the map on this.
Yeah, because it's, you know, it's not a plot character driven movie. It's an awesome action movie. It's kind of hard to focus the discussion.
It's true. Except it kind of is when it needs to be. Like,
sure. Yeah.
I think the character work in this one is really good. I like what they do with. Not just Ethan, and this does do a little more to characterize Ethan than the other films, but also just the people around him. I think it does more with Ilsa Faust that I really like. I think bringing in Julia at the end is smart, and I like how they, you know, kind of bring all of that together. Because if you just left it where they left it in Ghost Protocol, that was always going to be a very weird question mark on the series.
Yeah.
And I think they do it perfectly right here.
I think they make great use of Simon Pegg and Ving Rhames as, like, the backup team. Like, they're very present in the movie in a way that works really well.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like anyone's getting the short shrift.
Yeah.
Like, this movie does not have the biggest, like, team composition cast, but you know, sometimes people go away for a little bit when they're not needed, but when they're there, they really feel like they matter. And I do think the plot is really smart. I think the general setup of having it start with I like that it starts with the syndicate from Rogue Nation has, like, fallen apart, but it's not gone, which is a nice, like, just little thing, because in most spy movies it feels like they beat the bad guy and now everything's okay.
Yeah.
But that's not how the world works. See ISIS.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, like, so they, you have these like rogue actors all over the world, and someone's trying to get plutonium, and then because Tom Cruise won't sacrifice Ving Rhames, they get away with the plutonium.
Yeah.
And then you kind of go on from there of him, and that is kind of his goal throughout the movie, is to get to the plutonium. They don't really pull the rug out from under you on that, but it's also not a rabbit's foot scenario where the threat is completely obfuscated and off in the distance and too cute by half. And I just think the way it moves and all of that is very smart. I think the espionage mechanics of the Henry Cavill character and the CIA versus the IMF and who's trusting whom and how much shit they're kind of trying to put up with in this one, it just, it works very well at each step of the way. And it
and being able to bring back Sean Harris from the last movie helps a lot, because you have a good villainous presence already set up that like... So that, like, because the Henry Cavill character doesn't work without that. Because the Henry Cavill character is, like, the big bruiser kind of guy. And it's nice that they kind of get to have their cake and eat it, too, with the villain situation in this one.
I agree. Yeah, and, you know, I just think the other thing is that the action is fucking phenomenal. It's some of the best I've ever seen in an American Hollywood movie. But it is also contextualized within the plot sort of unusually well. Like, it does not feel like... Because there are, and this certainly happens in other Mission Impossible movies, it happens in lots of different action franchises where the leap from whatever's going on in the plot to, and now we're going to do a crazy stunt, is not always smooth. And it's okay when it's not. It doesn't matter, you know, you can paper over that. But when it's done well, and you're thrown into the action because plot mechanics have been very well set up, like the moment in this movie where I knew that third act was going to be special is they're flying to India, where they're going, or wherever. I think it's Kashmir.
Yeah, Kashmir.
So they're flying there, and Simon Pegg kind of comes and says, "Hey, guys, I figured out how to defuse the bombs. Like, the thing is, we have to do it after the timer started." And I just, like, put my hands over my hair, like, oh, my God, that's an actual impossible mission.
Yeah, because it's like, we need to do it after the timer has started, and then we need to have to defuse both bombs at the same time, and we need to have the detonator. So it's like, we need to have three things, and the timer has to already started, and we have to do it all at the same time.
So, like, think of how much is riding on all this by the time you get to Kashmir for the climax. Is that, one, you've had a full movie of double crosses and plot turns and twists where Ethan Hunt keeps getting near his goal but keeps having the rug pulled out from under him. Like, he's never on top of the situation the way he usually is. And then you get through all of this that there's been this thing out there of like, okay, they have this plutonium, they have these bombs. How are we going to stop that if they get it? And Simon Pegg figures it out, and now you're in this scenario where that sounds literally impossible, and no one knows how they're going to do it. That's just good plotting
that
sets us up for good action.
And then on top of that, they've already set up the Julia character from like the very first scene of like the dream sequence at the beginning, but then also you've got like a couple of other appearances and like mentions, and then you have just like that great scene of like, I mean, the whole chase sequence of Tom Cruise just hauling ass through fucking London trying to catch up to Henry Cavill, which is the longest sequence of Tom Cruise running in any of these movies for certainly. He just fucking goes. And then it culminates in him hanging off of the bottom of that elevator with Henry Cavill, who just puts the picture of Julia down on the floor. Like that, they set up that side as well, so there's another personal stake on top of it there. It's an immaculately constructed finale.
Yes, and, you know, Chris McQuarrie wrote and directed, as he did with the last one, and it's a good action script on top of all that other stuff. So
yeah, it doesn't lean on the cliches quite as hard. Tom Cruise does say one time, and that's exactly what they want us to do. I think he only says it once instead of like four times in the last.
My favorite cliche, because this is at this point the Mission Impossible equivalent of them finding a lost city in every Uncharted game, is he's in the room with Ving Rhames and Simon Pegg, and he says, "Okay, we can't trust anyone outside this room." I think at least half the Mission Impossible movies have a scene with like that composition of characters where he leans over the table and says, "I can't trust anyone outside of this room."
Yes. Ghost Protocol definitely has exactly that scene. And it has that scene, and then he's also like, "And maybe I can't trust anybody in this room too."
Yeah.
He's like, I gotta fuck off and talk to someone else.
But this is why I know I love this franchise. Same as with like, when you get to like Uncharted 5 and they're finding another lost city, I don't roll my eyes. I go, "This is cool. I can't wait to find the new lost city." It's the same here where Tom Cruise is like, "I can't trust anyone outside this room." And I'm like, "Fuck yeah, Tom, you can't. Trust your buddies." It's awesome. Yeah. All right. So the best way to do this might just be to go action sequence by action sequence.
Yeah.
Actually, before we get to action sequences, the opening like pre-credits stuff where there's the whole thing where they botch the job and then they arrest the guy and they do the whole fake thing with Wolf Blitzer.
Yeah, and it's a nice callback to Mission Impossible 1 where they show that kind of scene happening where they're in the studio with like the fake walls and then the whole thing collapses, which I assume that must be something from like the TV show or something.
Yes.
Yeah, and just like creating this whole scenario. But again, in Mission Impossible 1, they show that from the outside and you know that's happening. And this, you're in it for the entire time. And I assumed, like, they didn't fucking nuke Jerusalem in this, like, and you didn't see this. Like, I know that I heard that this is a darker Mission Impossible movie. It's not that fucking dark where it's, like, fucking millions of people are dead before, like, the main action starts.
I suspected, but I was truly curious, especially because, like, they lean on some of the moments in that scene in the marketing where, like, you know, Tom Cruise wants to beat up the guy and Ving Rhames is like, Ethan, that's not who we are.
Yeah.
He's like, maybe we should reconsider that. And I'm like, is this Ethan acting? Is this not? And then when you realize, like, okay, this is faked. But what about the wolf? I'm like, did they get real Wolf Blitzer? And then it's him in the mask. Yeah. That was genius.
Yeah, that was a really good – and it was, like, a good way to sort of – because I think they could do a good job at the beginning of this movie with, like, the dream sequence and that stuff of setting up how heavy the stakes are. But then they're able to kind of, like, lighten it up a bit so that once you actually get there, it can – like, you have that variation in tone.
Yeah.
So it's like the movie doesn't – like, the movie – sort of gestures that's going to be very dark, but then it finds a way to lighten the tone up so that you can actually go down that road to get dark by the end.
I think that's something to talk about in this movie is tone, because this is far and away the most serious of them since the first one. Like, the most sort of sober, down-to-earth, like, it's the one where, like, the punches feel the most real, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, but it's not humorless. Like, they have not lost, I think, the edge J.J. Abrams, like, gave it in Mission Impossible 3, where, like, people can joke and be human and laugh. It still feels human. It has moments where you laugh. But it is dark and serious when it needs to be, and it does have a much more pervasively dark tone. And I just think that's an interesting line, because in Hollywood it's often one or the other. You know, you're going to go super jokey or you're going to go super dark. You know, Marvel can balance it well when they want to.
Yeah, but that's the sort of stock and trade of the best Marvel movies, like a Black Panther, a Thor Ragnarok, or a lot of the Captain America ones, is that, like, we can be funny and we can be dark and we know how to balance those.
But this one does, like, there is just a pervading sense of dread to this film that I found impressive.
Yeah.
Like, it does not, it's a popcorn movie, you know, and that's there's nothing wrong with that. But it also does feel a little more just weighty than this movie usually is today, you know?
Yeah.
Because it just feels... It's a very raw film in a lot of ways. But yes, okay, so you have that whole opening. Also, just one more thing on the Wolf Blitzer thing.
Yeah.
I like that because, like, I don't know what movie was the first one to do it. But for, like, 20 years now, we've had the thing where they... News anchors are, you know, media whores. And they want to, you know, be in a movie too. And so you've had things with, like, Wolf Blitzer and Jake Tapper and Bill O'Reilly and Charlie Rose and people like that who, like, will do the scenes in the movie or the TV show so it feels real.
I specifically remember, like, Batman v Superman has, like, five of those sequences it, right?
Yeah. Yep. And so, like, Bill O'Reilly was in, like, multiple Marvel movies, I think, which... weird, but whatever. Yeah. But, like, in this one, I like that it's... I mean, obviously they got Wolf Blitzer on set, but that it was one of the dudes in a mask. That was a nice twist on that formula for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. All right. So that's good. And then, yes, you have the actual action stuff. We talked about the Halo jump. That's amazing. I love the stuff in Paris. That stuff is... Like, it doesn't get into, like, a full espionage sequence a la the ballet stuff from 5, but there is just a super stylish edge to all that stuff at that weird show they're at.
Well, what it kind of feels like is, like, if it was... If we're comparing it to Hitman...
It feels like Hitman.
Mission Impossible 5 would be that sequence, but I'm playing the game. Mission Impossible 6 is that sequence, but you're playing the game.
That's a good comparison.
And, like, every step kind of is progressively getting more fucked up. It was like... I would have just taken care of that dude in the bathroom, and you're like, oh shit, and fucking shooting all over the place and fucking throwing stuff and can't quite get it done. And so it's like it just spirals out of the control in that bathroom.
Yes. That bathroom fight is great.
It's so good.
And the way it ends, and that is also Ilsa Faust's introduction into the movie.
Yeah.
I love all that.
Yes. I really love that moment when Ethan Hunt looks up and sees her just like, what the fuck? Like, what the fuck are you doing here?
So, because that's, what's the name of the, like, fake alias guy they're chasing? Is it Jack Lord or something?
It's not John Locke, but it sounds like John Locke.
John Lark. It's John Lark.
Yeah, because there's a bunch of people that have British accents there, and they keep on saying John Locke. And it sounds like they're saying John Locke. And I, for half the movie, I was like, is it supposed to be John Lark or John Locke? And I can't fucking figure it out.
Yes.
It sounds different depending on who's saying it.
So this is the first John Lark. But he gets shot. And Ilsa is very mysterious, which is great because Rebecca Ferguson plays that so well.
Yeah.
She's awesome. And I just, it's one of those moments of which there are many in this movie where everything has gone to shit. This whole mission has gone pear-shaped. And, you know, Ethan is just looking at this bloody Hulk on the floor. It's like, well, I have to figure out what to do. It's like, I guess I'll just go without the mask.
I love how, again, it was another thing that made it feel like you were playing Hitman, is how massive the bloodstain was on the ground.
It's really good.
Like I thought it was going to be a little thing, like a little thing of blood. It's like, no, I guess that dude got super fucked up when he got shot in the head, because that is a lot of blood on the floor.
That is a realistic, maybe, amount for a head wound.
Yeah.
Yes. I was actually surprised they got away with it in a PG-13.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's like the one violent... You can do whatever the fuck you want in a PG-13 as long as no one bleeds.
Yeah. And they do make really good use of the one F-bomb later when Henry Cavill is just like, why do you have to make shit so fucking confusing?
Yeah, that was good. But yes, so one F-bomb and one puddle of blood. They made very good use of it. I like when the three assholes come back into the bathroom.
Yeah.
And it makes it look like Tom Cruise has been punched.
Or Henry Cavill has been punched and Tom Cruise is just there. It's like, you want a fucking piece of me?
Yeah, that's great.
Back off, motherfuckers.
But yes, they have to just leave the body there and go. And then there's the whole scene where he meets the White Widow, who...
Yeah.
I didn't realize when I was watching it. Apparently, that character is supposed to be like the daughter of the Black Widow in Mission Impossible 1, the Vanessa Redgrave character.
That makes sense. I think because there were... I don't remember what exactly it was, but I think there was some sort of callback that felt like they were setting that up. Like something like a music sting or something. I was like, oh, wait, is that going to be that character?
They're not super in your face with it,
no,
which I like, but like it's a nice little callback, and it also makes more sense why the CIA is working with her, if that's the case. But yeah, because this movie, other than Mission Impossible 2, does callbacks to all the other ones. I don't really know how you do a callback to Mission Impossible 2, other than what you've said of flashback directed by John Woo, just completely changed the aesthetic of the movie for a couple minutes.
These people are just like, for Ethan was fucking crazy for a couple of years there. I don't know what happened.
Ethan got on coke and man,
it's like he was jumping all over the place. He kept these doves in little cages with him. He took them with him everywhere he went. He thought it was cool. I thought it was fucking stupid. I don't know.
You know how Ethan's a pretty good shot? Not when he was on coke. Had to take two guns, fire them through the air. That'd be great. That scene later on, we're getting mad at ourselves, where Ving Rhames does the little talk about, like, Ethan in the past and everything, is so good. I do want, like, a bonus feature where Ving Rhames, as Luther Stickle, just, like, tells the story of Ethan's life very empathetically. Yeah. And, like, he's got such a great voice.
Yeah. I just want all the Mission Impossible movies from his point of view of him just, like, picking up newspapers. Like, motherfucker, he's at it again.
Exactly. Especially the ones where... Like, I think they should have done an alternate cut of Ghost Protocol that's like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead, but it's with Luther Stickle, who was not on the mission, but just like being like... It's like he turns on the Kremlin and sees it blown up and goes, same old Ethan.
Someone calls him... He gave them... You're saying he gave them the nuclear codes. You mean he gave them fake ones? He gave them the real... Oh, fuck.
Same old Ethan.
Same old Ethan.
All right. So anyway, all the stuff in... Paris at the beginning of this one. Then what's the next like action scene after that?
Is it when it's London and it's all like the car stuff? Because the London sequence is like a very long.
There's a ton in the. Yeah. This is one that does the big like interconnected action sequence. Yeah, because they eventually are able to like get one of the cores back, right?
Yeah, well, because you have the whole thing where...
The courier lady.
Yeah, where she says we have to get the Sean Harris character back.
Yeah.
And that's the whole... The Solomon Lane, we have to get him back. And,
yes.
And that's sort of how... Like, that's basically your currency in this. And you have that really good sequence where it sort of... does a flash forward and you kind of don't have the context for it of Tom Cruise and all the guys doing the mission but shooting and killing everybody, and then it flashes, you see it's like Tom Cruise sort of envisioning that's what their plan's going to be, and then so you have like some expectations of how the scene is supposed to play out, and then and so it's set up, well, how the fuck does Ethan do this without murdering 50 French cops? That's like obviously IMF is able to do some stuff, but they're not just able to, like, murder Parisians at will.
Yes. So I'm looking at the Wikipedia plot summary to help us follow this, and I love the next section of the movie we're going to be talking about, which is, like, at least 40 fucking minutes of everything you just set up of like what they're going to do. And now Ethan has to figure out how to do yet another impossible mission and get Solomon Lane without hurting anyone, but also not giving any information away. And it is this massive interconnected series of car chases, motorcycle chases, foot chases, all that stuff.
Yeah, there's like five different teams involved. It seemed like Luther and Benji and Isla and Ethan. It's just like, holy
here's,
shit.
Here's all of that on Wikipedia.
Okay.
A motorcycle and car chase ensues across Paris, with Hunt avoiding the White Widow's forces, the police, and Ilsa, who has to kill Lane to fulfill her mission for MI6. That's the whole thing.
Yeah.
But that's good action filmmaking, though, honestly, is you've got to be able to take a little bit of plot and make it feel significant over time, because I do think that entire fucking set piece in... They're actually still in Paris at this point, I guess.
Because after they get Solomon, that's when you go to London.
This is some of the best car-based action this side of George Miller I've ever seen. Especially because, and this is one of the things that feels borderline hallucinatory about this movie to me, is it is all location stuff.
Yeah.
Like, there is, I'm sure there's some studio work, but it's not action sequences. And so you just have, you know, Tom Cruise in a car or on a motorcycle just going 100 miles an hour through the fucking streets of Paris.
Yeah.
All on display. And they even, like, they are very proudly using the entire widescreen frame to just show all of it.
Yeah, and all, like, these very distinct landmarks you've seen every, like, Arc de Triomphe with, like, the traffic circle and then going backwards. Yeah.
And it is so intense. It just sort of keeps going. This is one of those cases where they get up to the line and then cross it 10 times.
Yeah.
Just to keep that extended and going and going and going. And there are some ins and outs that I don't even fully remember at this. Like, there's the whole thing where, like, they finally do get Solomon Lane. And I love that part where Tom Cruise, like, jumps into, like, the sewer. And they think they've got him, but then he's down in the boat with all of them, and that's great. And then you think we're going to pause for exposition, but we only get about 90 seconds of exposition. And then he has to take Lane, and now he's on the chase where he's being chased by Ilsa this time.
Yeah.
It's just... There are so many things, because I love in that Wikipedia line, it's the White Widow's forces, the police, and Ilsa, and that's true. It's like these three different factions all coming after Ethan Hunt and Solomon Lane, and so much is going on, and it is just this like little symphony of car chase action, which is one of my favorite kinds of action.
Yeah.
And it's great.
Yeah. There's just some standout moments to me are like when it's when Ethan and Henry Cavill are still in the big truck and they're like trying to get away and they drive into that alley until the truck is completely stuck, kick the fucking front like windshield off and climb out and get their motorcycles because that's how they planned it. And then Ethan's motorcycle doesn't start at first, which is how he ends up having to fight all the cops. And there, for a moment, I thought what they were going to do is his motorcycle wasn't starting. And you can see over in, like, the corner of that shot, like it's kind of out of focus. So I think that's probably the visual clue of that they weren't doing that. But there is, a normal bicycle, like, leaning up against this building. I'm like, is he going to fucking just grab that bicycle and, like, they'd have a motorcycle chase with cops where he's just on a fucking bicycle? Which I wouldn't have put it past them. They decided, maybe we do that for the next movie. Well, this one, we'll just do a motorcycle chase.
Awesome. Tom Cruise could have made it work.
Yes.
Fuck it. At some point in Mission Impossible 8, he's going to be on a unicycle, dressed up as, like, a mime.
He just, like, jumps up and is, like, riding on the unicycle down, like, a fucking, like, stair rails, like, right on it.
You know what I think it's going to be? Unicycle chase through San Francisco. He's just going down these, like, giant San Francisco streets on a unicycle.
He gets on a Segway and is, like, tries to start the Segway. It's like, stop fucking going, and looks, and, like, some hipsters abandoned their unicycle off the side of the street. He's like... There it goes! And yeah, next shot is like a big wide shot of him fucking racing away on a unicycle.
I'd watch it. You know?
Me too.
He's gonna be 70 in that movie, because he's 14 years away from it. Yep. But anyway, alright. So, that whole section is just... You know, if we had seen the movie more times, I would almost want to do like a shot-by-shot analysis of it, because it's just... It's truly great filmmaking. The editing, the cinematography, the amount of practical work being done. Like, obviously, there's got to be some CGI in there, but it's invisible to the eye.
Yeah.
And it just feels so immediate and genuine and raw. And, you know, it's just, you realize how much of action filmmaking these days is a lost art. You know?
Yeah, and that sequence specifically has another moment kind of like in Ghost Protocol when he's swinging and it kind of like gets me of like him suddenly hitting his head on the top of the window. Of in this when he's still running away from the cops and on the motorcycle and ends up crashing very suddenly. And like that's when you know that, like it's like you know, people use the expression on the edge of your seat, and usually it is just an expression, but in sequences of this movie, like that one, I was literally on the edge of my seat, and when he crashed, I'm like, fuck!
Yes.
Yeah, like, it startles you, in like, it's basically like the action movie equivalent of a jump scare,
yep.
Only for an action movie, it's a lot harder to do.
I find, in this one in particular, I do a lot of, like, literal jaw drops of, like, mouth agape at what I'm watching, or, like, I just, like, have to do some kind of physical release, so I run my, like, hands through my hair and just, like, lean back, like, oh,
yeah,
my
it's like
God.
I'm just, like, pumping my leg furiously in the chair. Yeah.
And that's why I know it's good, if it can provoke, like, that kind of physical stimuli. It's crazy. All right, so then you have the whole thing where Alec Baldwin comes back, and you have the big, like, let's see if we can figure out how many double crosses happen in this scene.
Okay,
so
yes.
The players in this scene are Tom Cruise, Henry Cavill, Alec Baldwin, plus Simon Pegg and Ving Rhames.
Yes, and we know, obviously, that Ethan Hunt and then Benji and Luther, they're all good. Like,
yes.
Nobody's, there's no gun, there cannot be any double cross between those guys.
Yes.
They're tight.
Yes. So, first, Alec Baldwin lays out the evidence that they found that Tom Cruise is John Lark. Or that Ethan Hunt is John Lark.
Yes, that we had seen in an earlier scene that Henry Cavill had given to Angela Bassett.
Yes. And so he's like, you're the bad person, Tom Cruise, and we're gonna get you.
It's like, I don't think that you're actually a bad person, but the evidence is here and we need to do this.
Yes. So then he, like, incapacitates Huntley, right?
Yes, yeah. Tom Cruise incapacitates Alec Baldwin.
And then what they do is they have, so he says, okay, we're going to go, Benji is going to be Solomon Lane, and they make the mask. He's like, we're going to go meet these people.
Yeah.
Walker, the Henry Cavill character, you stay here with Lane.
Yeah, because he basically gets the Walker character on his side, because that's also where then Alec Baldwin has the line from the trailer that I think there's like, why do you think he's here? He's an assassin.
Right.
He's here to kill you if you step over the line. And so there's like already a like slight betrayal or something, double cross of like, oh, like, yeah, like Henry Cavill, like, yeah, he's definitely going to kill you if you step over the line, assuming he's the CIA agent that we have told you he is. And so then Tom Cruise is like, okay, if you want the uranium, Henry Cavill, like, I'll knock out Alec Baldwin. Now I'm your only hope at getting the uranium, which is what he has been established as his motivation so far.
Yes.
And so Henry Cavill's like, okay, good. Ethan and Benji and Luther all fuck off and go to do that shit with the mask and all that. And yeah, and leaving Walker / Henry Cavill with Solomon.
Yes, so Solomon Lane and Walker are together, and Walker winds up doing a whole monologue for himself about how, like, you know, it was his idea, it was his manifesto, he's John Lark, he put all this together. Yeah.
This is the F-bomb of why do you have to make this so fucking complicated, which it's I appreciate, because it was just like, why do these people have to make this so fucking complicated? You're right, Henry Cavill.
Yes, and then it turns out that was Simon Pegg, and they took the real Lane, and this is, I assume, what you were referring to with one of the best mask reveals.
Yes, yeah, of because that was one where it took me a little bit into the scene to be like, wait, there has to be another twist here. And it was like, I think I realized it right before Henry Cavill realized it, which is what you want to happen. I think that's the ideal way for a scene like that to play out. And that whole reaction of him, like, he's repeating that Angela Bassett line of, you know, the IMF is like Halloween, you know, there's a bunch of grown men playing with meth. He's like, facial expression, like, I really, this isn't good, this is bad.
Yes, I like the Wikipedia line for this one. After being asked to monitor Lane, Walker unwittingly reveals himself to be the real John Lark. Like, it's like, we're not going to try to explain all the mask stuff, let's just simplify this.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he unwittingly reveals it. So we have another double cross here.
Yeah.
Then they call up...
Because that's then when, like, Hunley comes back and sort of reveals, it's like, okay, this has been a whole thing, and then... And
it so goes, it's all staged, yeah.
Yeah, and because then you have, like, a little sort of, like, sleight of hand or whatever, where Henry Cavill takes the gun from Hunley, is like, aha, now I have the gun, and then Hunley's like, ah, it wasn't loaded, because here's the actual gun I have that is loaded, which is another little, like, extra bit on top of it that's a little extra
that was,
flair I loved.
That's fantastic. Then they call the Angela Bassett character, whose name is apparently Erica Sloan. I didn't get that.
Yeah, she's the CIA director.
And so they're like, they present her the evidence, and she's like, fuck it, and sends in a whole team to just take all of them.
Yeah.
And so now we're
at first it seems like she's on the IMF side.
Yes.
And because she was part of the Sting thing to reveal Henry Cavill's character. And then she's like, no, actually I'm going to send the CIA people in just to take care of all you people because fuck it.
Yes. This whole sequence I love so much because it's about 5 degrees away from a Monty Python sketch.
Yeah.
Like, it is, like, 5 degrees away from... If you played this for laughs, it would be fucking hilarious.
Yeah.
But they play it straight, and somehow it works. Because I think it's, like, just ludicrous enough, you know, that it's actually surprising, but it is also done with, like, they've done the tonal work of, like, building us to this point, and it is a lot of payoff all at once.
Yeah.
And then you get a really cool action sequence in the dark.
Yes. Well, after you get the next double cross, which is the final one, which is the CIA hit people get there, and they're like, okay, I guess we'll have to, you know, survive the CIA hit people, but we've captured John Lark, we've kind of saved the day, and then John Lark, Henry Cavill's like, oh, did you really? Hey guys, hit it! And they're like, and then he has his people in with the CIA hit people, so then the hit squad is actually on Henry Cavill's side.
Yeah, this is at least a quadruple cross.
Yeah, there's
point.
Like five or six of them in there. There's a lot.
It's great. Alec Baldwin dies at Henry Cavill's hands.
Yep.
Maybe the only misstep in this movie is you can't really expect me to be sad when Alec Baldwin dies on screen, because frankly, it's kind of cathartic.
Yeah.
You know, if only he was doing it in the Donald Trump makeup. I'm kidding. All right. So, but that part's all good. And this is the other thing. They have a really... IMF has a bad track record of secretaries dying horrible deaths out in the field. They're going to have to talk about that at some point.
Yep.
If I were Angela Bassett, I'd be freaked out.
Yeah, it's just, you know, you don't want to be one of the top people in this organization, because you're either going to double-cross everybody and then get killed, or you're going to be the good one and get killed.
Yes.
You get killed no matter what you do. You either turn to evil or you stay on the side of the IMF. You're going to get fucking killed.
3, 4, 5, and 6, the secretaries died
for
all of those. And I don't think we saw that. In 2, it was Anthony Hopkins, and he was just super sexist. But he didn't die.
I'm not totally convinced that Anthony Hopkins was actually a part of the IMF. I think he was just like a weird British dude who showed up and like started babbling at Ethan Hunt.
Yeah.
And Ethan Hunt interpreted it somehow as a mission.
Okay. Maybe he was like the courier of the mission info.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Anyway, so all of that happens, and then we have... So this is the other one thing I wish they would have done differently, is as Alec Baldwin is dying, you know, Tom Cruise is getting ready to go run, because he's got to go chase after Henry Cavill. I do wish Alec Baldwin's last words would have been like, he grabs Ethan's hand, looks him in the eye, and goes, run.
Yeah.
They should have done that, and then had Ethan tear out of there, but they don't do that. But Ethan does tear out of there.
Yeah.
And, like, because this whole sequence creates like this like just pressure cooker situation, he comes out of that scene like a fucking cork out of a wine bottle or a champagne bottle, and he is just running all out. You're thinking to yourself, no 56-year-old should be able to do that.
Yeah.
This is crazy. And yeah, it's this movie does not have the most Tom Cruise running like net, but it probably has the best. And certainly this
and like the
is
most like, contiguous, probably.
Yes. Probably the most contiguous, because you have he's chasing this guy. They've put a tracker on him. That was the other double cross. As they
because when we took out the tracker that was in Solomon Lane for the bad people tracked him. Now we have our own tracker in there too, which is good, because when they took out the tracker, I was like, why don't they just put another tracker in there? And then later they decided you did. I'm like, you're a good guy, Luther. You thought of it. You thought of everything.
Good.
Why you're on the team, buddy?
Yes. Ving Rhames always thinks of everything.
Yeah.
All right. So he's chasing, and Simon Pegg has the whole thing up on his iPad, and they mix in some very good humor here.
Yeah.
With him not really reading the map right. I love the moment when for a while it's been clear he's not realizing that Tom Cruise is on the rooftops.
Yeah.
And he turns it, and it's a 3D schematic. That was great.
Yeah. He's like, oh, I'm sorry. I had it in 2D.
Yeah. That's fair.
Yeah, because that's where you get again, like the so many of the trailer for this movie is so good. That you had that shot of Tom Cruise being like, I'm jumping out of the window. And I like when you have a shot or a sequence like that in the trailer and seeing it in the trailer actually makes it seeing it in the movie a little bit better, because the little like punchline off of that of then cutting back to Simon Pegg and him doing like, oh, it's in 2D. Sorry. That joke actually I think landed better because you knew the setup from the trailer.
It's so good. This is another one where it's like all location stuff as he's running through London now?
Yes, they're in London, yes.
Yeah, so now we're running through London, and then it, of course, culminates in him getting on the elevator with Henry Cavill, who has the image, the photo.
Yeah.
Man, it's really good. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's just really fucking good. It's a good... I feel like you don't have enough action movies that just do a good foot chase. It's a lost art.
Yeah, and Tom Cruise broke his fucking ankle for it.
Yes.
So there you go. All right, and then we have all the stuff in Kashmir, which is one of the best made, most ludicrously complicated in terms of how it must have been put together.
Just utterly awe-inspiring action finales I've ever seen. Like,
yeah.
It's truly extreme in like every sense of the word.
I mean, I don't even know where to start. we did say the thing about the setup with Simon Pegg being like, "Yeah, we have to do it all after they've started the countdown."
Yeah.
That's great. But when he goes after that helicopter, it's like one of them is already taken off. He's getting on the other one, but he can't get on the other one. He can get on the rope on the other one and get up there. And the detonator is flying away, and everyone else is like, "Well, we've lost. We got to get these people out of here." And Tommy's like, "No, I'm going to figure it out." Yeah. And I love through that whole sequence up to the moment he actually gets to the detonator. I don't think he at any point knows how he's going to do it. He's just like, "I'm going to do it. I don't know how, but I'm going to do it." Really, these movies are testaments to the power of positive thinking.
Yes, absolutely.
Because,
Well, another component of like all this stuff that I love that continues throughout most of the sequence is, you know, because you kind of are split between the Henry Cavill, Tom Cruise stuff and then the rest of the team back in the Kashmir medical camp trying to find the bombs. And while they're trying to find the bombs, they're occasionally getting sort of play-by-plays by Ethan about what the fuck he's doing. And you get like these little reactions of like, "Do you know how to fly a helicopter? Like, you do realize he's in the other helicopter, right?" Like, and it's just them sort of pointing out how much he has left to do and how just severely the stakes are stacked against him.
Oh, yeah. Because that's it. Let's talk about the inner cutting here.
Yeah.
Because you have basically three or four discrete action set pieces going on, but cut together to show like how they're all interacting.
Yeah.
That element alone is masterful before you even consider how well done each of them individually is. But so you have Tom Cruise in the helicopter chase. You have Simon Pegg and Ilsa are together trying to find the other bomb.
Yeah.
And you have Ving Rhames and Michelle Monaghan defusing the bomb they've already found.
Yeah.
And it's actually a really good, like, also, like, layered sort of thing going on where the smallest one is just Ving Rhames and Michelle Monaghan trying to defuse the bomb. But that feeds up into the other two because it's a very small personal thing. It's reminding you of the personal stakes because it's, you know, Ethan Hunt's two favorite people in the world right next to each other. And they're just trying to defuse the bomb. So, you know, like, okay, it's a nuclear fucking bomb right here. That's what they're trying to do. Then you have a more, like, you know, grounded action sequence with Simon Pegg and Ilsa Faust going around trying to find Solomon Lane, find the other bomb. That turns into a whole fist fight with Solomon Lane and everything. Yep. So you have that, which is also very immediate. And then you have the big fucking action on the helicopter that looks like they made a wish on a cursed monkey's paw to get that fucking footage. And they're all going to die in 3 days or something.
Yeah, like Tom Hanks is some, like, had, it's not Cats, it's Tom Hanks that has nine lives. Or Tom Cruise. Tom Hanks also. But Tom Cruise has nine lives, and he spent five of them on that action sequence.
Yeah, probably.
There are parts just like, no human being does this. You can't do this.
Yeah.
You should be allowed to do this, Tom Cruise.
So, yeah. And I just think that inner cutting is so smart because every one of those smaller pieces makes the other pieces better.
Yeah.
Like, the helicopter stuff is always better when you go back to it because you realize you're always being reminded what's riding on it, which is that nothing these other people are doing counts for anything, and in fact they're all going to die if Tom Cruise doesn't get to Henry Cavill in this one.
And it's also just helps keep each section feels fresh because they each have a kind of a little bit of a different tone to them. And so, you know, it's not just, because if it was just 10 minutes of a helicopter chase, it would be cool, but it wouldn't be cinematically, I think, very exciting and wouldn't have the tension you want. And being able to cut between these different kinds of set pieces makes each of them work better because it's a very long sequence overall. And if it was any of those individually uninterrupted, they'd get kind of dull.
Yeah. It's wild. Let's talk about the helicopter stuff, Sean.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's all, even if you're not watching it in IMAX, you can probably tell, it's all shot on IMAX film stock. So it's super clear, better than any kind of digital photography you could ever get. Better than 35mm, which is what the rest of the movie is shot on. So it's like hyper clear. Like, they want you to know they're really doing this because you can't fake it on that kind of film stock.
Yeah.
And man, it only gets better from here, but when it's starting out and he is on the rope trying to get up and the helicopter's already way up in the air, and I love that this is how good Chris McQuarrie's action instincts are, is the first time he gets to the top of the rope, he slips and falls all the way back down. And he's hanging off of it. And so he has to do the whole thing over again. That whole part where he's having to climb up the rope and get up into the helicopter felt like Tom Cruise and Chris McQuarrie watched the beginning of The Dark Knight Rises, where Bane, the whole action sequence on the plane, and they said, "Christopher Nolan's a pussy. We can do this better."
Yeah.
Like, that feels like that. It's a direct reaction to that of like, let's do it and actually just have our star hanging off the fucking thing.
Yeah, have him hanging off the thing, and then once he climbs up and gets into the helicopter, we're going to send the helicopter a do like a spiraling corkscrew dive into like the mountains of fucking India.
Yes, because from the moment he starts piloting that helicopter, it's falling apart and his time is limited and he doesn't really know how to fly it.
Yeah, that's just such a great moment of him just being like, okay, so that's top speed. I guess this is power. It's like, where's the payload? And very nicely, the guy wrote on Sharpie on the thing, and this is the payload button. Like, great. Okay. It's like, I know three things about this helicopter. I know how to go faster. I know how fast I'm going. I know how to drop this thing. And that's kind of it. That's probably enough.
But all the helicopter photography, and when the two helicopters are, like, in combat with one another, when they're just flying, when Tom Cruise is in a corkscrew, whatever, like... It is some of the most amazing location work I've ever seen done for a major Hollywood movie.
Yeah.
Like, it is unbelievable, some of the shots they got, and how good it all looks, how contiguous it all looks, because that's one of the hardest things about any kind of location photography, is continuity is super difficult with that. And I'm sure they were able to do some color correction and things like that. But it just, there's like... You are so in the illusion of the movie. There's no moment where you're like pulling yourself out and being like, eh, but it was all Hollywood and it's, you know. Like, I was saying this to my brother. Intellectually, through that whole sequence, you know they're not going to let a nuke go off and kill all the characters.
Yeah.
That would be unprecedented for this kind of movie. They're not going to end this with everyone dying at the hands of a nuclear bomb, cut to credits.
Yeah.
But at any point, does that like enter your any other part of your being while watching it? No. Yeah. Like, it ends with... You know, they cut the last wire, cut to white, and then go to Ethan Hunt on the side, and the sun coming up looks like a mushroom cloud. And you're still thinking like, oh my god, did they do it? Edge of your seat, out of breath. And again, the logic of course they're not going to do it, doesn't matter. It doesn't enter. That's how good the filmmaking is.
Yeah, and it is that the editing, it is the shots they were able to get, it's the choreography of the whole sequence is so perfect, and how they, like, even just, like, within each, like, sort of discrete action sequence, just how they progress and evolve, even in, like, the simple ways that, you know, the relatively calm... As far as the disarming a nuclear bomb can be calm sequence in a movie is with Ving Rhames and stuff, and sort of talking about Ethan, there's a nice evolution of how those sequences all move that keeps it fresh, that keeps it exciting, that keeps the tension up. And yeah, and then especially when that fucking helicopter stuff starts like really going for it. There are a couple of just like particularly choice moments, like when he drops the payload, or I think maybe my favorite discrete moment in this entire movie is... like pretty deep into that helicopter chase where they like he's Tom Cruise, I think, is after he's dropped the payload and it didn't work, and then like he's kind of up and like he looks over and he sees Walker Henry Cavill, and Henry Cavill sees him, and Tom Cruise just looks like, that's right. It's just like, because it's already been like 15 minutes to get to that point for Henry Cavill to even quite realize that Tom Cruise is even there at all. And so it's just that moment of, you know, it's well before Tom Cruise or Ethan Hunt has the upper hand, but it's just like a, I am here, motherfucker, like, this is how far I'm going. That might be my favorite moment in the whole movie.
It's fantastic. You then have the whole part of the sequence, because it is like a series of sequences. It's like movements of a symphony, where Henry Cavill pulls out the giant fucking gun and just starts shooting at him, and he's having to do all the, like, helicopter foo to get away from him, but... My favorite discrete moment, Sean, the one that made me, like, audibly gasp, was where Tom Cruise, he realizes that all of his, like, warning lights are on, there's smoke coming out, he's like, I don't, and he just so, like, he's right behind the Henry Cavill helicopter, so he just goes, fuck it, and he just goes and just rams the helicopter in midair, and they don't cut. I don't know how they did this shot, but he just goes in, and in, like, one fluid take, you see the helicopters, like, collide from Ethan's POV, just crumple and then go down together.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing, if you're really used to seeing the, like, shots from inside a car in, like, a staged car crash in a movie where you're in the car and everything's rolling around. I think maybe, actually, this movie might have an earlier one with the car that they do. You're not used to seeing that from a helicopter.
No, you're not.
Because fucking crashing and rolling a helicopter is a lot more dangerous than crashing and rolling a car. And I'm like, he was like, I don't know how they got the shot. Like, some of those helicopter shots, I'm like, I legitimately do not know how this happened.
Yes.
Like, this looks like everyone should be dead.
They definitely, there's a lot of things they let Tom Cruise do in these movies. They didn't let him crash a live helicopter.
I agree with you. I don't think they let him collide two helicopters in midair while he was piloting one of them.
But it looks like he did.
Yep.
It sure looks like it. And then you have the whole thing where the helicopters are rolling down the mountain, and Tom Cruise has to get out, but he doesn't. Like, you think he's going to get out, he doesn't. And then they're both, like, in the fucking, like, crevice on the cave.
God, that's such a good shot of, like, the, again, and it's kind of calling back to the alleyway in the big truck. But now it's vertical as this little crevice and both of the fucking helicopters jammed in there. It's such a good shot.
It's so good. And then them trying to fight their way out of that. And he, now we like, this is the first time he has the detonator in sight.
Yeah.
And I love it's gone through all this work up to and including crashing two helicopters. Now he sees it. Still has no idea how to get it off this guy. But he sees it. This is also where Henry Cavill gets his face burned off.
Oh yeah, by the fucking burning oil. That's a good touch.
That's a good touch. They get out of there. They're on the side of the mountain. They have a big fight, and then they fall off the side together, and we get a nice callback to Mission Impossible 2 and climbing up the mountain freebasing.
Yeah, but like throughout this whole sequence, one of the helicopters has fallen totally off the cliff,
that's true. The other one
is dangling by a single hook off the edge of the cliff, and that hook breaks and catches again, and so they're hanging on the line from connected to that hook and the helicopter and trying to climb back up.
Yes, but I love the moment where Tom Cruise is like, I could keep climbing this rope. I was able to kick Henry Cavill back down, but it will be safer if I just freebase the climb the side of this mountain. Yeah.
And that's when you get, I think, what is the best villain kill in any of these movies by quite a margin, which is he's freebasing, like just climbing up the mountain with his hands, looks down, sees Henry Cavill doing the same thing, looks at the rope, looks at how, like, it looks at the helicopter, looks at how, like, tenuous the rope is, and he just grabs it, and he just yanks it as hard as he can. The whole thing comes undone, and the fucking hook just goes swinging down and smacks Henry Cavill in the face and pulls him from his face down to his death in the cabin.
Because it's a super fluid shot. It's he gets hit and then cut, and we see the body going down, the helicopter going down. The helicopter blows up, rolls out of the frame, and his body gets pulled into the explosion and all gets rolled out of frame together. It's so good.
It's such a great action movie death. It's because it's also something I've never seen that done before. It's perfect in all the right ways.
And then after all of this, he still doesn't have the detonator.
Yeah.
Again, that rule of, like, we get to the line, cross it three times. At this point, we're like, the line was 20 minutes ago, and we're still just putting more and more walls in front of the character.
Because meanwhile, Luther has basically had put the first bomb up to the point of it being
ready to go.
And then Simon Pegg and Ilsa had to have their whole fight with Solomon, and fucking Simon Pegg almost gets, like, hanged to death. And finally she, like, sort of subdues Solomon.
That is a traumatic moment. I don't want to see Simon Pegg hanged to death.
Yes, no. I love Benji. I love Simon Pegg. He's, like, one of the most likable people in Hollywood. Like,
yes.
It hurt to see him be physically injured in any way. But then now they're disarming that bomb, have that bomb to the last point, and then you remember, oh, right, they have no way of radio contact with Ethan because he's, like, out in the middle of nowhere in the fucking Indian mountains in a chasm. And so they're, so I just love that they're both like, well, how do we know that he does it? I guess we don't. I guess we just cut it at the last second.
No, but what they do is, like, we'll go on two. And they're like, no, let's go on one. Let's give him all
the time.
It's
like, do you want to leave it up for the last second? It's like, we'll just go on one.
Yes, they go on one. I think the implication is Ethan got it on one.
Yes.
And that's it.
And I think, like, the perfect choice was them doing the, like, cut to white.
Yes.
And then faded out into just a gorgeous shot of Tom Cruise hanging off the side of that chasm, like, looking out at the sun, like you said, like at first looks like a mushroom cloud, and then you do the reverse shot and you can see that he has the thing, and he spits it out of his mouth. It's like, holy fucking shit.
It's so good.
It's one step away from being a literal mic drop.
Yes.
He drops the detonator, but if he should have just had a fucking microphone and dropped it off the side of the mountain, because that's what that is.
Yeah.
It's so good. I don't know what else there is to say about all that. What do you think about how they integrate Julia, the Michelle Monaghan character, in the, like, last act of this?
I liked it. Yeah.
I liked it a lot.
I thought it was nice to have that little bit of continuity. It always felt weird in 4 and 5 how kind of, like, in the wind that character was with how important 3 set her up as. Especially with, like, the ending of 3 is, like, an almost, like, Breakfast Club-esque, like, yeah! We're all together and married and it's great! And it's, like, pumping my fist in the air.
I like that Luther gets to deliver the exposition.
Yes.
Because Ethan would never tell that story.
Yeah.
But Luther gets to tell it. He gets to tell it to Ilsa, who's, like, a new important person in Ethan's life. I like all of that. And then seeing her... And it does not feel all that convoluted. It is obviously a little convoluted, but it does make sense. She is a doctor. That was canonically set up. She is kind of off the grid. That's canonically set up. And these evil people know who Ethan Hunt is and would be able to figure that out, so that they brought her here does not not make sense. You know? So, like, all of that is good. And, again, it just... putting it all there on the line and having that, like, tie into humanity there, or his humanity, I think works a lot.
Yeah. And it has a quality of, like, I hope and expect that they'll make another Mission Impossible movie, but if they don't...
it's a great finale.
Yeah, it's a perfect finale. If, like, if another one of these movies never gets made for whatever reason, like Tom Cruise gains some shred of its sanity, and he's like, I'm 56 plus years old, I can't do this.
Yeah.
Yeah, if that ever happens, that's never going to happen. But it adds this quality of finality to it and bringing back all those characters and the villain and all that.
Yeah.
I liked it a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I agree. Like, this isn't the kind of case where I'm like, this is such a perfect ending, they shouldn't do anymore. I'm totally up for them doing more.
Yes.
But if you had to end this series, this feels like the best way you could do it.
Yeah. Because also, I legitimately don't know how you could top the finale of this movie. I've seen other action movies where, like, that kind of felt that way, but this is like a, especially with, like, how far they push it. Like, it goes so far to, like, the white screen at the end of this. Like, I don't know how you up that ante.
You have to go smaller, like, because, you know, one interesting thing also to talk about is that while this is a direct sequel to Rogue Nation, and it is the most direct sequel we've done, this and Rogue Nation are very different movies. Like,
oh, yeah,
I think Chris McQuarrie did a good job not repeating himself, because Rogue Nation is much more of an espionage film. This one is much more of an action film.
Yeah.
I think you would have to go back in, like, the espionage sort of direction, although even then these movies have such big stunts, you'd have to do something, but, yeah.
I'm sure Tom Cruise has some fucking, like, he hasn't been in space yet, right? Right?
He hasn't been in space. I did hear, there was a clip of an interview, I didn't listen to the whole thing, where Chris McQuarrie apparently said at the world premiere, he and Tom Cruise were sitting together, and when the credits rolled, Tom tapped him on the shoulder and said, that was really good, but I think we can do better. Which is the most... that feels like that is Tom Cruise's personality
in a nutshell.
Yeah,
that sounds like the most Tom Cruise thing he's ever done.
That's what he's going to say right before the shot where he jumps off a building and dies, and that's how his life ends.
It's like, oh, we could do better.
Yeah, we got the shot, Tom. You jumped off the building and survived. We can do better. And that's the end of his life. I don't know. Yeah, it's really good. This movie's great. Movie, yeah. I want more of these movies. I am curious where they go from here.
Like, yeah, I definitely don't think they can do another one in, like, the next 3 years. I think they need to take another, like, 5-year gap.
Yeah. I wonder if... I'd be totally up for Christopher McQuarrie doing another one. I wonder if he's interested. There is going to come a point where Tom Cruise's age is going to be a problem. It hasn't happened yet, you know, so we'll see.
You can just do a Rebecca Ferguson movie.
Well, I was going to say that. Yeah. Like, at a certain point, I want a movie that's just called Mission Impossible Faust.
Yeah.
Because that's a great title, and that's a great name. Ilsa Faust, that is the best character name in these movies.
Yeah.
That and Luther Stickle, maybe. Luther Stickle's a really good name. But yes, Ilsa Faust is a great name. I think she could totally carry a movie. It's going to be interesting to see, though, because this one also is probably going to gross more than any of the other movies.
Yeah.
And we'll see what Paramount wants out of that, because, again, they... I say this in Transformers, but the last Transformers movie didn't do so well, and I don't know, call me crazy, I don't think Bumblebee's going to light the world on fire.
Although I saw the trailer played in front of this one, and this is the first time I've seen that trailer again since I watched it on YouTube, and I'm like, that's a pretty good trailer. I kind of want to watch that movie.
It is.
I want to see the cool teen lady with her cool robot guy. That's a good premise for a Transformers movie.
It's Hailee Steinfeld from True Grit.
I
like her. So, yeah. Yeah, who knows? But it's, you know, look, it's a Transformers movie not made by Michael Bay. That's a little miracle in and of itself.
Yep.
So who knows? But yes, this one's so good. This is definitely my favorite movie of the summer. I want more. I always do. But this is so good.
It's fucking good. Yeah.
It's fucking good. All right. One other thing I did want to talk about. The music is by a guy named Lorne Balfe. And if you thought the music in this movie sounded like Hans Zimmer did the score, and you were really surprised when it wasn't Hans Zimmer's name at the end, because some parts of this sound directly lifted from the soundtrack to The Dark Knight, it's because Lorne Balfe worked for Hans Zimmer for like 20 years.
Okay.
He's one of the many composers in Hollywood who got his start at Remote, which is Hans Zimmer's studio. And I actually think Lorne Balfe might even have a credit on some of the Dark Knight movies as like one of the co-composers or something, like in the, those are always deep in the credits where you would find that, but like one of his assistants or something. So he's worked with Hans Zimmer forever. This is a better Hans Zimmer score than the actual Hans Zimmer score for Mission Impossible 2, which I think is amazing. But it's a great score. My brother's actually met Lauren Balfe at a composing workshop or something.
Cool.
He did a bunch of the Assassin's Creed games, but this is one of his first movies. And I was very impressed by the score because because of the specific rhythm of the action in this movie and the specific darker tone, it needed a very different kind of music, and I think they nailed it.
Yeah.
So there's nothing they really didn't nail in this one, but that's one of them. All right, let's rank these motherfuckers.
Okay.
All right, I'll do my rankings first because I've thought about this more.
Yes, and I literally just watched all these movies for the first time over the course of like a week.
Yeah. All right. Mine's, I think, pretty easy. I would go Fallout, Rogue Nation, 3, then 1, then Ghost Protocol, then 2.
Okay.
Yeah.
Ghost Protocol's low on that list.
It is. But I want to be clear. I really like all 6 of those movies.
Yeah.
And Ghost Protocol is like Mission Impossible 2, I don't even know. I'm putting it at the bottom because I don't know where the hell else I would put it.
Yeah.
It feels like a movie that fell out of an alternate dimension where the Mission Impossible series was really weird, you know? I mean, weirder than it already is. But yes, so like those top 5, I love all of those. It's tough for me because those, especially 6, 5, 3, and 1, I really like all of those. I could swap 3 and 1 even. But I really like all these movies. But that would roughly be my rankings. The McQuarrie ones at the top, and then 3, 1, 4, 2.
Yeah, I think I would do 6, 4, 5, and I don't know, 1 and 3 are very close for me. They're very different movies. Which, you put 3 above 1?
Yeah.
I'll put 1 above 3. I'll do 1, 3, 2.
Okay, that sounds good. So, fairly similar, but you've got 4 higher.
Yep.
Yeah, that sounds good. Yeah, 1 versus 3 is tough for me because they're very different. 3 does have Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yes.
Does have the Vatican stuff. It does not have the fucking Langley thing, which...
Yeah, I think the Langley thing is so good in Mission Impossible 1, it kind of puts it over the edge for me.
Yeah, and yeah. But the point is, you really can't go wrong. This is actually kind of a silly one to rank because they're all pretty good, but that's how rankings work. If you haven't picked up one of the multiple box sets they have of the 5 movies for like $10, just do it. Have some fun times, and go see Mission Impossible Fallout, because you're not going to have a better time at the movies this summer.
Yes, yeah. No, it is definitely a movie theater-ass movie. Like, you should go to the theaters for this one.
I mean, literally, we're just talking about it, and I'm feeling the same kind of, like, breathlessness, where I literally, when it did the fade to white, I realized I was, like, hyperventilating. Like, I'm not breathing. Like, this is... Someone made this tweet, it's so funny, which is that, you know, like, me, 25-year-old in the theater, out of breath watching Tom Cruise run. Tom Cruise, 56, free running all over London.
Yeah.
You know? It's crazy.
I mean, it is that quality of, like, when it does that flash to white, it feels like you should be, like, tripping over the movie theater seat in front of you because you're so far on the edge of your seat, you're just like, oh, fuck! And lose your balance.
Yeah, I do think the last time I felt this way in a theater was probably Mad Max Fury Road.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
So, that's high praise. Yeah.
They're very different kinds of action movies, but they are top tiers of their respective
this
forms.
Has been a good decade for action movies.
I agree. Yeah.
I think this, Mad Max Fury Road, John Wick 2, The Raid or Raid 2, and I'm sure there's some others I'm leaving out. Like, that already, for one decade, that's a hell of a list.
Yes, yeah.
I we're in a good moment.
Yeah, you can put some, like, Donnie Yen movies in there, too, for some more kung fu stuff, like some of the Ip Man's.
Yeah. So, anyway, action movies are cool. These movies are cool. Those King Kong movies I talked about are cool.
Yep, I need to go watch those.
Watch the shit out of these. And, this was fun. So we talked about some movies this week. We're going to talk about some video games next week. Next week, you guys are going to be hearing our 5-year retrospective on The Last of Us.
Yes, you will be hearing us talking about video games next week. We will have talked about video games like 3 weeks ago.
Yes. So, again, I'm about to go on a little bit of a hiatus as I move to Iowa. I'm leaving about 72 hours from now as we're recording this. So by the time you hear this, I won't have left, but I will have packed up more things into boxes. So, Sean, it's been fun.
Yes.
We're not ending the podcast.
No.
But, you know, I won't be sitting down here looking at your Persona shelf again for a while.
I could, if you can request to me what you want to see in the background of the shot, because I can move these chairs anywhere I want. You can see the Persona stuff.
Okay.
You can see X-Files. You can see whatever.
Okay. Maybe on a week-by-week basis, we'll change it up.
Yeah.
All right?
Just for you.
All right. Sounds good. So, we'll see you guys later.
Yes. And Jonathan, I hope you enjoy listening to the rock reflections of a superhero on your trip to Iowa.
It's a 10-hour drive. I could fit that in. like 20 times.
And only on that 20th listening will you have dug to the depths that Spider-Man has to offer.